Welcome to episode 83 of GBW. I'm Chris.
Over 83. There is three.
Over there is Josh.
Hi.
Wow, so enthusiastic. How's it going today?
It's going good.
At least you're not sick this time.
I know.
And you can actually drink a beer.
That's true. Two. I'm going to have two.
Whoa.
Maybe. I mean, I don't know. I kind of like the vibe of, you know, not drinking.
Being sober?
Well, I mean, I'm not like, it's not like I'm an alcoholic drinking, getting wasted every time we do it, but.
No.
No. But sometimes.
Anyhow.
Depends how long the episode goes.
That's true. That's true. And we're known to go a long time sometimes.
We are.
Well, today shouldn't be too bad. Today we're going to talk about buddy action movies.
Well, we were going to do buddy cops, but yeah. I protested.
We broadened the range.
Yeah.
So this was a topic that I wanted to do.
Yes.
That Josh was like, I'm going to have a struggle with this. And you did, apparently.
Well, it's not one of the, it's not like I hate buddy cop movies. It's just not something I watch often.
Well, see, and I like them.
I know.
And I watch them a lot.
You do.
So we're going to list our five top choices each.
Yes.
For this topic, but let's talk about what we watched first, and it shouldn't be too bad. We both only have like five movies each, so...
We do.
Why don't you start?
You want me to start?
You want me to start? I don't care.
Well, no, yeah, you start.
All right. Well, I'm going to get the poor out of the way first, because, you know, I want people to keep this podcast turned on
by talking
about
shitty movies. You always get the poor out of the way first, though.
No, okay, fine. I'll talk about
something. No, you can get the poor out of the way. You've already set it up.
I'll interspace them. So the first movie that I watched is a movie that was originally made in 2015, was delayed about four times before it actually came out. And when it actually came out, I got it for free on Google Play. Okay. And that's a movie co-produced by our buddies at Blumhouse called Amityville: The Awakening. Now,
sorry, you are getting the poor out of the way first?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. So... Like I said, this is a movie that was supposed to come out like 2 years ago, kept getting delayed. They'd give it a release date, then it would be delayed, then they'd give it another release date, and it'd be delayed.
Always a good sign.
And then eventually they said, hey, it's finally coming out, and if you go online now, we'll give it to you for free. So I was like, all right, fine, I'll go get it for free on Google Play, why not?
Yeah.
Now I finally watched it, and yeah. Free was too much.
Oh.
No, I'm just kidding. It's not very good. Okay. I'm not going to gloss that over. So basically what this is it's hard to tell what's actually part of the Amityville series now, because you cannot trademark an actual true event.
Right.
I'm saying true with my hands, like true as in bullshit.
Air quotes, yeah.
Air quotes. But you can't, you know, buy the rights to that. So that's why there's all these Amityville movies coming out all the time.
Oh, okay.
That aren't part of the series, because you can't say, this is my, I own the Amityville name, because you can't do it.
Mm.
It's not legal to own the Amityville name.
Okay.
So for me, the series has always been the Margot Kidder, Brolin one, and then... through four, then Curse, then like 92, It's About Time, Dollhouse. Okay. Pretty much ends at Dollhouse, right? But there's been like 8 or 9, 10, 14 since then.
Really?
Yeah, there's been a lot.
In my brain, it's like the first two.
Really?
But I've only seen the first one.
Okay. Well, anyway.
Which I didn't really like.
Yeah, the first movie is kind of shitty.
Is I don't it? Know. It's kind of a classic, though.
But it's kind of shitty, and I don't understand why people think it's a classic. I prefer part two.
Part two scared me when I was a kid.
Part two is also very fucking sleazy.
It's got that fucked up opening, like, where he kills his family.
Yeah, but it's...
That really messed me up.
It's sleazy and gross, too.
Gross, like how?
Because he wants to, like, get down with his teenage sister in this movie.
Oh.
Like, played by Diane Franklin from Last American Virgin.
Really?
And Better Off Dead, yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, see, I'm piquing your interest now, aren't I?
Yeah.
But, yeah. Anyway, speaking of the DeFeo murders, which is what Amityville 2 is based on, they start this movie with old, again, air quotes, news footage to give the backstory of the Amityville house. You know, the iconic house where it's like looks like a face when you look at it from the distance. And these murders occurred where this guy called Ronald DeFeo killed his entire family with a shotgun. And
yeah.
Then later the Lutz family moved in and supernatural occurrences happened. And
the Lutz family from The Conjuring, right?
No. The Lutz family from Amityville Horror.
Well, were the Conjuring people involved somehow?
They were brought in, like, the Warrens.
The Warrens, right.
They were brought in to, like, investigate in Amityville for a bit, too.
Right. Okay.
They were involved in Amityville.
Yeah.
So what this is, it has a family buying the Amityville house for cheap, and it's a single mom family. It's Jennifer Jason Leigh, never bad, as the mom.
Oh, she's in this?
Yep. And she has a teenage daughter played by Bella Thorne, who's from, I think, Pretty Little Liars or one of those shows that no one cares about, and a young daughter. And then they also have a vegetative state brother. So he's basically a brother who's in a coma who doesn't do anything. He's like really just a vegetable. So they move into the house. All the supernatural stuff starts happening, you know, and the teenage daughter figures out that the spirits are going through the brother. So she'll see the brother in the distance, like, winking at her and stuff. And she'll have nightmares about the brother. And eventually he starts getting better, which, because of the supernatural forces taking over his body. And the Jennifer Jason Leigh character looks on all, like, concerned about her son. And the teenage daughter goes looking into the backstory of the house. And she meets this nerdy guy at her high school who actually wants them to watch the original Amityville movie on DVD so they can get a backstory of the house, which is the only part of the movie I liked, was that it went meta for a minute, where, like, let's watch Amityville. Ho, 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 ho. This is the house. That kind of stuff. But it's just boring, dude.
I'm bored. Like,
it's just boring.
Hearing about it.
It's like,
you're not boring, but it sounds terrible.
I know. It's like the brother goes into cardiac arrest, but then he doesn't because it's just the house fucking with everybody. And then she sees her brother being this evil figure in the background and all, you know, it's got the flies like they had in the first movie and all that shit. I'm just like, and then jump scares all the time. Like, this is one of those horror movies I can't fucking stand, like newer ones that relies on jump scare after jump scare after jump scare after jump scare, which is why I didn't like Lights Out.
Right.
Which a lot of people seem to like.
Yeah.
If you're into fucking jump scares, great. But the story here is just boring. I've seen it before. I don't care. Bella Thorne's weak as shit as the lead. Jennifer Jason Leigh, not bad. Just not in it very much. So she can't prop up a piece of shit. I'm sorry. She really can't.
But so, she's not bad.
She's not bad.
So it's not like it hasn't proven our theory wrong.
She's never bad, dude.
Okay.
Never bad. But
why the fuck was she in this?
I don't know, dude.
It's weird.
But she's not in it that much. And I don't know. I found, like, you're trying to build creepiness on the brother. And the brother, because he's a vegetable, like, he's in a vegetative state, he just looks pale and, like, they're trying to make him creepy, but he looks fucking ridiculous. You're like, they look like they splattered pancake makeup on his face and shit during the movie to make him look creepy. I'm just like, I'm not buying this. I'm not buying this for 1 minute. So, I don't want to talk anymore about it. It's a movie that deserved to be delayed, okay?
I know what you mean. I know when you start talking about a movie and you're like, oh, it'll be kind of fun to talk about this. And then you start talking about it and you're like, fuck, this was so shitty. And there's, like, it's not even fun to talk about. Like, then it's really, really shitty.
I know. I'm not going to talk about it anymore. Okay. So bring me something good.
Well, I have a similar title that I was going to bring up, but maybe I should save that.
Yeah, let's not do two shit sandwiches in a row.
Okay. Oh, God, I don't know where to go here. Okay, we'll talk about the good one, really good one.
Okay.
Okay, so I've been wanting to see this one for a long time. It has
define a long time.
I've been wanting to see this for about 10 years, I know I've heard trusted friends, one in particular, mention this movie a few times, and it's been on my radar for a long time, and I know it's come out on disc over in Europe, but never had a really proper release here. But finally this year, it has come out properly from Blue Underground. Okay. And that is a Dutch movie from 1988 called Amsterdammed. Yeah, Amsterdammed, directed by Dick Moss, who gave us The Lift and all recently sent a movie called Sint.
I haven't seen Amsterdammed either, so you know. I have the Shameless DVD sitting at home.
Yeah, I've been wanting to see this for a long time. Yeah. I've heard good things about it. Yeah. And this is really good, man. And it's funny how it sort of slid under the radar. It's been pretty obscure for a long time. And even after Blue Underground's put it out, I don't think a lot of people really... I still don't think it's even really on people's radars. But it should be.
I remember the old VHS box.
Yeah, I remember the old VHS box, too. But it had a terrible... Like, it's a cool title, but something about the box just never made me want to watch it.
The box made it look like a generic action movie that was put out by, like, Action International back in the day.
Yeah.
Remember that company? David A. Pryor's company?
Oh, yeah.
It looked like one of their movies. So every time I was like, I don't know about this.
Yeah.
I'm into shitty action movies, but I don't know about this.
Well, I always thought it would be like an older person action movie, like The Rosary Murders or something.
Oh, really?
Yeah, like that's all kind of what I always thought. I was like, oh, this is like a parent action movie, you know? But no, I was wrong. Because this is like really entertaining. It's so Amsterdam, if you don't know, is a city kind of like Venice that there's a lot of canals running through the city, and the premise is that we've got a serial killer on the loose in the city who is swimming through the canals in a wetsuit with scuba gear, who like leaps out of the water and kills people. And it's pretty awesome. It's as awesome as it sounds. And
you know what would make it more awesome? If he yelled, "Surprise, jackass!" when he jumped out of the water.
No, he doesn't do that. But they are kind of jumpy scares. And they actually, when he does come out, it is pretty effective. There's a number of murders. There's a prostitute. There's a drunk guy. There's a woman on a dinghy and a kind of like Freddy Krueger Nightmare on Elm Street 1 inspired like the bathtub kill. Right. There's a couple of salvagers, and like the murders are really, really good. Like they're done in a slasher tone, but there's also, I've heard a lot of like the word giallo is thrown around a lot with this movie. I didn't really feel like it was a giallo, but some of the murders felt a bit giallo-y. So we've got, the movie opens with like kind of like almost like a Jaws theme. Like it's got like a kind of a POV shot of the frogman like in the water, and it's got kind of almost a Jaws score playing as he's like swimming through the canals. It's pretty cool, and we get a few shots like that throughout the movie. Pretty soon we're introduced to a police officer after the first murder who's trying to hunt down the killer. I really liked him. He's played by a guy named Hoob Stoppel, who's been in a number of Dick Moss's movies, and he's a cop named Eric Visser, really kind of the cool grizzled detective with the like 5 o'clock shadow, and really, really like this character. There's also sort of a love interest for him named Laura, and she's played by Monique Vandenven. And you probably don't know that name, but you might know her. She was in Paul Verhoeven's first movie, Turkish Delight, with Rutger Hauer, and she was also in Stunt Rock. So it's really the only thing she's done, but they are kind of both big deal movies as far as a cult movie fan goes. So it was cool to see her in it. It's got a freaking amazing boat chase through the canals, like a speedboat chase that goes on for about 10 minutes. It's awesome. I mean, I haven't seen a lot of boat chases in movies. The one that always sticks out in my brain is in Live and Let Die, the Bond movie, but this one topped that one for sure. And when I was doing some research about this movie, I did find that was also copped off another Dutch movie that also takes place in Amsterdam that has a really good speedboat chase in it as well. Unfortunately, I didn't write down the name, but maybe I'll post it or something. But it's also pretty hard to find. But this movie was about 2 hours long. It was a great detective story. I really enjoyed the mystery aspect of it. The murders were really good. It was really well paced. I really liked the lead cop. So, yeah, I mean,
totally would recommend this. And I think people should pick up this Blue Underground Blu-ray, because again, like, you know, we're always complaining that these companies aren't putting out, you know, they're, it's like, fuck, they're doing like a fifth, you know, the 50th dip of Army of Darkness or other movies like that, or Halloween. But when something obscure like this comes out, people don't buy it. And this is one, like, this is exactly what we want to see coming out, like some, like, kind of quote unquote hidden treasure that no one knows about, that's going to hit the market in a really cool Blu-ray edition. And that's what Blue Underground's done here. So I'd totally recommend watching this. If you've heard good things about it, they're all true. I mean, one of the main scene sequences that's been talked about is there's a body hung off of a bridge and a tour boat goes under it. And It's as cool as it sounds, because the body's like dragging over the top of this like tour boat ferry. It's pretty amazing. And yeah, I mean, it's not ultra gory. There's really not even a lot of nudity, but don't let that turn you off. If you want a really good detective story with some pretty great action sequences, in particular the boat chase, it's top notch. So yeah, I'd really recommend this. And if you are a fan of this movie, I'm going to post something on our Facebook page. I know Kirla Janice, the writer of House of Psychotic Women, she used to do some writing for Fangoria, and she did a piece called The Psychotronic Tourist, where she went to Amsterdam and like took pictures of all the film locations, and it's really cool. And she actually went out on a boat with Dick Moss looking at the locations, and it's a pretty entertaining video. So I'll post that. But yeah, absolutely check this one out. It's probably, yeah, the most, this has been like my first discovery of this year for sure.
So did you watch the Blue Underground Blu-ray then?
Yes.
And how does it look though and everything?
I watched the one I got was the they kind of botched the first batch of the Blu-ray,
right?
And then they fixed the problem and reissued it. I watched a botched Blu-ray and I didn't notice any problem at all. So I'm sure that the fixed up one.
Well, how was it botched?
I think there was a scene or something that was framed improperly. I didn't even notice if there was an issue, and I didn't care. Like, it was, so I mean, absolutely, it's worth buying.
Yeah, I bought the Shameless UK
right
DVD release of this before it was announced by Blue Underground.
Right, yeah,
and
yeah.
And then when Blue Underground announced, I was like, oh, god damn it.
Yeah, yeah.
But then at the same time, I haven't watched the Shameless DVD yet, yeah. So why was I that upset?
Yeah.
But yeah, I think I might have to give it a spin.
It's really good, man. Like, I mean, if you like cop thrillers, which obviously I love.
I like them too.
Yeah, it's really, really good. And yeah, and I just really hope people will gravitate towards this one, just because it is really good. And I'm really pleased that Blue Underground's put this out. So yeah, Amsterdammed.
All right, well, I'm not going to do another crappy one. I've got more crappy ones.
Oh, I've got some crappy ones.
I'm not going to do it. I'm going to do a movie that I watched because it was on your top five.
Ooh.
And that movie would be called Spider-Man Homecoming.
Really?
Yeah.
You watched Spider-Man Homecoming?
I did, dude.
Oh,
I watched
cool.
Spider-Man Homecoming. And I haven't seen a Spider-Man movie since Raimi's. So
right.
I didn't see the Andrew Garfield Spider-Mans.
Yeah, neither did I.
And, you know, I really liked Homecoming, dude.
All right.
Yeah, like, this was like, if you were to take a teen movie from the 80s, like a John Hughes type of movie, and slap it together with a superhero movie, that's what Homecoming was.
Yeah.
And I was consistently entertained through this whole thing.
I know.
I thought Tom Holland, who I have no idea who he was, I hear he's like a dancer or something, and he's been in a few movies. I thought he was fucking awesome as Peter Parker. Like, I thought he's probably the best Peter Parker I've ever seen.
Totally.
Better than Tobey Maguire.
Yeah, yeah.
Because he's supposed to be 15 in the movie, and he was just perfect playing Spider-Man. Because, you know, when he first gets, like, they don't, what I like is that they don't give you the backstory.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they're like assuming that when you're coming in, you know who the fuck Spider-Man is.
Yeah.
They don't have to rehash for you that he got bit by the spider, blah, blah, blah. So he comes in. This is after the events of Civil War, I think.
Yeah.
Loosely. I didn't feel like I missed anything by not seeing Civil War.
No.
And, you know, Tony Stark, Iron Man, played by Robert Downey Jr., kind of like says, okay, you're a young kid. We're going to maybe you want to be an Avenger, but first you got to learn how to use your powers and everything. So yeah. He gets all the fancy web shooters at. And I just liked how the actor conveyed his excitement.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he was really excited to be Spider-Man and to run around. And there's early scenes when he's like, he like stops a guy riding a bike who he thinks stole the bike. And then he doesn't know who the bike belongs to. So he just leaves a note on it saying, was this your bike? Did it get stolen?
Yeah.
And he just does little stopping little petty crimes like that. But he's super excited all the time. Yeah. He's like, I got my web slingers. I'm cool. I'm fighting crime in New York City. And I'm like, those scenes were just super charming. I was just like, this is great. I love these scenes. Then you throw into the mix that Michael fucking Keaton is the bad guy.
Yeah.
And anyone who knows me in any way knows that I fucking love Michael Keaton.
Yeah.
Like, Michael Keaton is in my top five actors.
Mm-hmm.
And he is such a good villain in this movie.
Yeah.
Like, he's so good because he's one of those villains where he's not over the top.
Yeah.
Which is what kind of keeps me away from a lot of these superhero movies, is that the villains are too over the top. You saw that in, like, Raimi's Spider-Man 3.
Mm.
Like, the villains, like, Topher Grace's Venom and Thomas Hayden Church's Sam, and we're just too over the top.
Yeah.
In this one, Michael Keaton is fucking menacing without being over the top.
Yeah.
Because he's very subtle. Like, yeah. The way he talks to people and the way he looks at people is very subtle. And they give him the Vulture stuff, like his rig, but it's not overused until really till the finale.
Yeah.
But, you know, I just really thought it was a lot of fun. Like, yeah. It was 2 hours and 12 minutes long. Didn't feel it.
Yeah.
I'm watching. I'm like, you know, I'm really, really enjoying myself here. I liked Tom Holland. Like I said, I liked his best friend.
Yeah.
He was like the nerdy, overweight kid who like stumbles into finding out his best friend's Spider-Man. And I think he's even more fucking excited than the guy who is Spider-Man.
Yeah, yeah.
That he knows Spider-Man.
Yeah.
You know, and you've got like, I really like Jon Favreau as
Happy.
Tony Stark's kind of keeper. He's like the guy who's supposed to watch over Spider-Man. I really liked him, and it was nice seeing him in a movie because he directed the first two Iron Man movies.
Yeah.
So it was nice seeing him actually acting again
because
he's kind of known for doing like Jungle Book and, you know, all these movies now. And I thought he was really good. I thought the action in the finale got a little bit too chaotic for me.
Right.
Like, I was like, I don't really know what's going on right now at times.
Right.
Because it was just so clang and bash and close up. But I really did dig this movie. I think that it might have snuck. It probably snuck in. It would have been an honorable mention, at least in mine. I don't know if it would have snuck on my top five, but I went into it going, you know, I don't really like superhero movies. I haven't really seen any of the new ones. And I was mostly basing it off you being really happy with it, because I know you see most of them, and then hearing decent things about it on the side too.
Yeah.
And hearing like, well, if you like the Raimi ones, you should like this one. And Spider-Man Homecoming is pretty fucking rad.
Well, and even though the end action, I agree, was a little chaotic, the other big set pieces were really cool.
Yeah, like the
Washington Monument and the boat. Yeah,
yeah, I really dug this movie, and I'm actually looking forward to the sequel to this. I'd probably actually maybe break my rule and go see a superhero movie in the theaters again.
Yeah, well, the new Avengers comes out this year, right?
Yeah, I haven't seen any of those.
Yeah, I don't know if you need to, but that's going to be an interesting one,
too. Yeah, so I really dug it. I was surprised. Pleasantly surprised.
Yeah, and I talked to a friend at work. We've talked a few times about the Marvel villains. Like, they're just, not a lot of them are very memorable. Like, if I think back on all the Marvel movies, like, I don't remember a lot of the villains well. Like, I remember a couple of them, but overall, they're just kind of generic. But I thought Michael Keaton really kind of stepped it up.
Well, that's what I said, because he's one of those villains where in comic books, I always find, like superhero books especially, I always find the villains to just be over-the-top caricatures.
Yeah.
Whereas in this movie, Michael Keaton, his actions made sense, and he was very, very menacing when he wasn't in his getup. Like, he conveyed it. Like, he could just look at someone and you'd be like, oh, fuck.
Yeah.
They're in trouble. You know, and that's what bringing a guy like Michael Keaton in to be a villain is a great move, because he's a fucking spectacular actor.
Yeah.
And for him to pull it off, I mean, he's my favorite villain that I've seen in a superhero movie since Alfred Molina in Spider-Man 2.
Oh, yeah.
As Doc Ock.
Yeah.
Like, really, I thought he was great.
Yeah. No,
but I really, really liked the main guy, Tom Holland. I really liked him in this.
Yeah. And you might want to check out Civil War too, because he's in that quite a bit too.
Yeah, I thought it was all around a really fun roller coaster ride. And
yeah,
I don't say that often about these kind of movies. So yeah, if you haven't seen it, you should check it out.
It was really good. Yeah. Right on. Okay. Well, let's just get this one out of the way.
That's always a bad thing when you say that, because I was thinking the same thing about Amityville. I'm like, let's get this out of the way.
Yeah, I just feel like I need to talk about it, but I kind of don't want to, and I kind of feel bad.
This is my Amityville. This is like your Amityville of your list.
What is it? Watched Death Race 2050.
Oh, you poor bastard.
Okay, so directed by G.J. Etchenkamp. This came out last year. I'm a big, big fan of Death Race 2000. One of my probably top 10 movies of all time.
I think you're the biggest fan of Death Race 2000 I've ever come across.
I love Death Race 2000, and I love the characters in it. It's got all my favorites in it. It's got David Carradine. It's got Roberta Collins. It's got Mary Warrenoff. It's got Sylvester Stallone. Like, it's a really fun movie. If you haven't seen Death Race 2000, highly recommend checking it out. So the premise is it's a transcontinental road race where they're driving from one end of the country to the other, but they need to try and get to the finish line first, but they also get points by running over people, and they get different points based on the age of the victim. Like, kids and elderly people are worth more than regular people. That's not at all.
Yeah, this idea was kind of cribbed in the original Toxic Avenger.
Yes, yeah. It was. But it was a great concept when it came out in the 70s, and it was perfectly executed. And I still think the 70s one holds up, because it's a nice lean, like 80 minutes, might even be less.
It's 79 minutes.
Yeah, yeah. And it's just a fun movie.
And it's actually very satirical at the same time, but it's not like beat you over the head satire.
Yeah.
And it's... I always thought Death Race 2000 was like a perfect drive-in movie.
Yeah, it really is. This one is not
so much.
This one was awful. I'm sorry, but I'll just say that right now. It tries to take the same concept of Death Race 2000, obviously. We've got Manu Bennett playing Frankenstein, so the Carradine character. This is pretty much, they're calling it a soft reboot. It's trying to be a remake, but it just, you know, because it's the same concept. It's a race across. There's a resistance going on that, you know, doesn't like the death race, so they're trying to thwart it. There's a, you know, a corrupt president. There's some really obnoxious TV reporters that are really excited about the death race and like the tolls and stuff. But nobody in this movie can hold a candle to the original. So Manu Bennett, you know, you might know him from like the Spartacus TV shows. I think he's also on like Arrow. So he's kind of a more of a TV action guy. He did nothing for me. So each driver has a navigator with them. The navigator in the original was very memorable. In this one, she's played by a woman named Marcy Miller. Don't know much about her. She's probably the character I liked the most in this. But in the original, like, the navigator is in... So, spoiler alert, but I'm assuming most people have seen it. She's in cahoots with the Resistance. Her aunt is one of the Resistance, the leader of the Resistance. So she's kind of trying to... She's kind of a spy, underground spy. That whole aspect of this, it's still in this, but I felt like it didn't really work the way it was supposed to. The Stallone character is awesome in the first one. His name, Machine Gun Joe. In this one, they've decided not to have that type of character, and they've got a guy named Jed Perfectus, who's like this, he's like a really like kind of a pretty boy who's always like got perfect hair and stuff, and like a real like arrogant dick, and he again it comes across as really non-threatening, whereas Machine Gun Joe I thought was quite a good foil for Carradine's Frankenstein, and this guy just I didn't find threatening at all. They've replaced all the other classic characters from the original. This one, we've got a African American woman who's kind of like
I think she's like a pop star that's decided to become a racer, and she like keeps singing this song that's fucking terrible, and she just keeps going like drive, drive, kill, kill, and it's really, really, really lame, but it's repetitive throughout the movie, and it's like the worst song ever. We've got a self-driving car, and the driver of the car isn't like, there's a driver in the car, a woman driver, but she's not driving because the car drives itself. So her only purpose is to get masturbated by the car. So it's trying to be sexy, but it like totally fails and makes no sense. We've another one's called Tammy the Terrorist, which didn't work at all as far as I was concerned. It's got this weird VR angle where it's showing all the people in their homes watching the race through VR goggles. And it's just this weird angle that doesn't really pan out or work. We've got Malcolm McDowell playing the president. Malcolm McDowell is a great actor, but he can really go either way. And I felt like on this one, he was just there for the cash. A lot of Trump overtones with this guy, but again, like I just didn't care. I wasn't really entertained. And then Yancey Butler plays the leader of the resistance, and I feel like she is really finding her way in B movies. Like she's been in a lot of asylum movies. She was in the one of the Lake Placid, or a couple of the Lake Placid movies. I think she's actually doing pretty well in this. I mean, Yancey Butler used to be a TV star, and she kind of went through a rough patch personally, and it's kind of made a bit of a comeback in these B movies. And I find she's always pretty solid, and she was pretty solid in here. I thought she was the best part, but yeah, overall, man, holy crap. Like, don't waste your time at all. Now this Jason Statham movies also rebooted the Death Race franchise, but from what I remember from the first one, it kind of dropped the whole running over people thing.
Yeah.
And which seemed bizarre to me. It was just more like a race. I think the first one took place on like a prison island or something.
Yeah.
And it was
that's really, the only one I've seen.
Really kind of boring, I thought.
That was okay.
Was it okay? I want to rewatch it, but because there's like three or four, I think there's out now.
There's and a fourth three, one coming. But there's a fourth one coming. See, the funny thing is that I listened to an interview with the director of this movie, Death Race 2050.
The Maron one?
Yeah.
Yeah, I also knew that too.
And they said that it was just basically Universal throwing Corman a bone.
Yeah.
And saying, hey, you can make a new Death Race movie, but just be aware that we're still making our series.
Yeah.
So there's still going to be a Death Race 4 coming out. But you can go make a low budget one if you want. And then, you know, the cars were like outfitted with like foam, painted foam or something. Or
right. I mean, well, it was molded foam. But I mean, yeah. I'm sure in the original it was just fiberglass.
Yeah,
as well,
I know.
Right?
But I just thought this one looked really cheap when I've seen any footage from it.
It's just bad. I mean, the cars look kind of cool, but it's just not a fun movie.
I'm just finding a lot of the new Corman stuff, though, is not very fun.
And I hate knowing that because, you know, I listened to Chris was referring to an interview on the WTF podcast by Mark Maron, and he interviews the director of this movie, and then he interviews Corman. And Corman is 90 years old and still, like I loved listening to that interview. I thought he was great. And I feel bad kind of dissing this movie because I don't know what happened, but it's just, I just think that this doesn't work in this era anymore. Like, I don't know. You either have to go balls out or not. And I felt like they didn't really in this. It was trying to be hip and it's bad and it's not worth your time. So it's unfortunate, but I did have to check it out. Just being a fan of the original, I just wanted to see. It's terrible. So.
No drive, drive, kill, kill for you.
The drive, drive, kill, kill will drive, drive you cray, cray. So, yeah.
Cray, cray, huh?
It's, no, it's so annoying. And I'm just like, did someone actually think this was cool? Or like, are they just like purposely trying to be bad? And I don't feel like they were. Like, it was like a really bad asylum movie. So that says a lot. So, yeah. So too bad. Sorry. Sorry, Death Race 2050.
All right, well, let's go and talk about one of the things that I dislike about the horror genre, and that's horror spoofs.
Oh.
And let's talk about a movie from 1985 called Transylvania 65,000 that I sat through. And let's just quickly explain the reason I sat through this movie was A, Jeff Goldblum, B, Ed Begley Jr., C, Gina Davis in a very, very cleavage-bearing vampire outfit. And that's about it.
And the theme song.
Transylvania 65,000. It was actually a pretty good theme song, I gotta admit. But, okay, so this is a movie written and directed by Rudy DeLuca. Rudy DeLuca is actually known mostly for being a guy who writes with Mel Brooks. So, you know, he wrote, like, High Anxiety. He worked on a bunch of the Mel Brooks movies. I don't know how the Mel Brooks movies managed to be fairly funny when this movie is an incoherent, unfunny mess.
Yeah.
So this is basically Jeff Goldblum and Ed Begley Jr. play American tabloid reporters. And the opening scene is them in the office with the editor, played by Norman Fell from Three's Company.
Okay, Mr. Roper.
Who sends them to Transylvania to look into this footage that's shown up of these guys who are backpacking being attacked by the Frankenstein monster. So, yeah, Transylvania and Frankenstein. Automatically, you're already going against type. So they end up going out to Transylvania. They meet the mayor, played by Jeffrey Jones, who says, Transylvania doesn't have monsters. You're so silly. Of course, we know that's not true because there is a Italian mobster-sounding mad scientist played by Joseph Bologna in a castle, which has been turned into a hotel, which our tabloid reporters stay at, who has a Frankenstein monster. He has the Gina Davis vampire creature. He has a Wolfman character played by Donald Gibb, who played Ogre in Revenge of the Nerds.
Right.
And he has a sea monster and so on and so forth. They go out through Transylvania, causing a little bit of havoc while Ed Begley Jr. gets himself in the situations because he's kind of a dunderhead reporter. And Jeff Goldblum just basically smirks at the camera saying, what the fuck am I doing in this movie? You can totally tell. There's times when you can tell Jeff Goldblum's just like smirking because he's like, what am I doing here?
Yeah.
It's not his character. He's literally smirking going, why did I sign on to do this? And I like Jeff Goldblum. And this was made the year before The Fucking Fly.
Yeah.
And I'm just like, dude, why?
Yeah.
Why are you here? Carol Kane shows up in this. She's in Scrooged.
Young Frankenstein, right?
No, that's Terry Garr. She might be in Young Frankenstein. She's also in When a Stranger Calls.
Right, yeah.
And also John Byner shows up from the TV show Bizarre, which I watched religiously as a kid. They play a couple who are like the maid and the butler. And I thought they were pretty fun. I thought they had some pretty good chemistry with each other. And they were always like insulting each other. And they were okay. And Jeff Goldblum, it was fun watching him smirk his way through the movie looking embarrassed. But the movie is not funny. There is nothing that goes on in this movie. It just kind of wanders from one set piece to the other, but there's no real plot to it. Like, oh, let's throw in Gina Davis as this vampire who has her boobs hanging out, who wants to, you know, hook up with Ed Begley Jr.'s character because she loves him. I'm like, no, let's have Joseph Bologna talking like a fucking, he's from The Godfather, but like making werewolves. I'm like, no, I'm just like, what's going on in this movie? I'm like, I've come to the conclusion that any movie that thinks that a whole bunch of really loud yelling of characters loudly yelling at each other is funny is fucking wrong. And that's what the jokes were here. It was people just yelling at each other at the top of their lungs through the whole thing. I'm like, oh, it's so fucking tiresome, dude.
Yep.
And then you have Michael Richards, who played...
Oh, God, you're losing me.
Who played Kramer on Seinfeld... playing a character who I think is mentally retarded. Excuse me.
Yeah, that's not a good term.
Mentally handicapped. Who wants to be a comedian, and he keeps doing all these jokes of like his hand falling off when he goes to hand someone something.
Yeah.
Or he goes and he's always bugging the reporters, and he's always like, "It's funny, no? It's funny." And it's not funny.
No, that it's does not funny sound funny. At
all. It's like it's trying to be Airplane, but like failing miserably at being Airplane. I actually got to say that I think Saturday the 14th, speaking of Roger Corman movies, is better than this. Right. And if you've seen Saturday the 14th, you know that that is quite the feat.
Yeah.
So, yeah, the only other thing I want to say about this movie is that I did find an interesting story out about it when I was looking into it after I watched it, that this movie was actually funded by Dow Chemical Company.
Really?
Because they had a whole bunch of money tied up in Yugoslavia, and the only way they could get it out of the country, because there was laws preventing them from taking the money out of the country, was to produce a film in Yugoslavia.
Oh my God.
So that they could get their money out of the country. And the result was Transylvania 65,000. Yeah.
Okay. I got a couple of comments.
Okay.
So, first of all, Carol Kane was not in Young Frankenstein. The movie I was thinking of that she was in was another Gene Wilder movie called The World's Greatest Lover.
Oh, okay.
That's why I was confused. I was thinking black and white Gene Wilder, and that's...
She was When a Stranger Calls and Scrooged are the two things I mostly know her from.
Yeah. Secondly, I liked a lot of... Like, I liked horror, and I liked comedy.
Yeah.
And I actually liked the combo a lot more when I was a kid. This was 85, right?
Yeah.
So I was a teenager. And I liked horror comedy. And I remember loathing this movie when I was that age. And if I hated this movie at that age, I can only imagine how much I'd hate it now.
Dude, it was painful.
Yeah. Yeah, it's all I remember is that theme and hating the movie.
Transylvania 65,000. It was like a new wavy kind of song. I'm like, yeah.
It was a catchy theme.
I'm down with this song. And then I see Norman Fell. I'm like, oh, yeah. I'm like, this might be okay. And Jeff Goldblum's smirking away. And then it just kept going and kept going and kept going and kept going. And then when Donald Gibb shows up at the werewolf, I'm like, at least yell nerds at somebody and then I'll be okay.
Yeah.
But no. It's fucking miserable.
Okay. Yeah. Good to know.
Yeah. We're really selling the good movies this time, eh? Just Amsterdam's and Spider-Man, I guess.
I watched a remake.
Really?
Yeah, an 80s remake. So a remake from the 80s.
Oh, okay, so it's not a remake of an 80s movie.
No, and you're good at casting these things, so let's see how you do.
Okay.
So it's from 1985.
Okay.
It's directed by J. Lee Thompson, and it's an Indiana Jones ripoff.
Oh, shit. Alan Quartermain?
The first one. Yeah. King Solomon's Mines.
King Solomon's Mines, okay. Yeah. Canon Films.
Canon Films. In the house. 1985, directed by J. Lee Thompson. And now J. Lee Thompson, he's one of these directors that's been kind of all over the place. Guns and Navarone.
Yep.
Happy Birthday to Me.
Yep.
And a bunch of Charles Bronson
movies.
Yeah,
a whole shitload of Charles Bronson.
Including 10 to Midnight.
Movies. Yeah, and Assassination, and there was a bunch.
I think Murphy's Law.
Yeah, he did a bunch.
A whole bunch of them. So similar to Transylvania 65,000.
This is a movie you loved as a kid?
I fucking hated this as a kid.
Oh, okay. Then why?
Because I loved Indiana Jones.
All right.
And I hated this.
Oh, is Sharon Stone in this one?
Oh, she is. Oh,
okay.
We'll get to her in a minute.
I'm trying to remember which one this is because there's two of them.
She's in both of them.
Okay.
And Richard Chamberlain's the star. So this is a remake of it's been remade a few times, but kind of the famous one was, I think, in the 50s, starring Stuart Granger and Deborah Kerr, I believe. And it was a really fun adventure movie.
I think it's actually from 1950.
Oh, is it?
Yeah, okay. I think so.
So I remember really liking that one.
Yeah.
But I hated this. So, you know, it starts off and, you know, pretty much immediately there's like, we were introduced to our lead character, Alan Quartermain, played by Richard Chamberlain. Now, Richard Chamberlain seemed like a really unlikely action hero because he was like kind of the TV god at that time. He was in like Shogun and the Thornbirds and some other, he was in a bunch of like TV miniseries, and that was kind of his thing. And then he like shows up in this as the star, and it's like, what? So he's playing this like kind of cool, smart, snarky, Indiana Jones type character.
But with a Chuck Norris beard.
Oh, yeah. And I remember not liking him, but this time around, I'm like, okay, he's okay. Sharon Stone is like, she's like Willy in Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom, but worse.
No time for love, Dr. Jones.
No, that's the little...
Oh, that's Short Round.
That's Short Round.
Which one's Willy?
Kate Capshaw.
Oh, okay.
Right? Like, everyone know, like, if you, you know, the Indiana Jones, if you're a fan of the Indiana Jones movie, it's always Temple of Doom. It's always the female, like, the weak, weak, weak female that you just kind of don't like. And it's just kind of,
she's
like,
no Karen Allen.
Screaming all the time. And, yeah, and it's just, like totally, like, almost an annoyance. Like, she's got really nothing to offer. And it's just a fact. Sharon Stone's character is very similar. She's just fucking complaining all the time, and like the fish out of water who's on in Africa, like on some sort of quest.
Man, I'm so glad they flipped that stereotype on its head when Romancing the Stone came out.
Yeah. Yeah. Totally, yeah. And, you know, I mean, and I'm glad that they've made other movies. Like, you know, I'm kind of thankful for movies like Tomb Raider flipping that on its head. Yeah. Not that I'm really a fan of the Tomb Raider movies, but it is kind of nice to get rid of that stereotype.
The first one was decent.
Yeah, but I don't like those types. I don't like annoying women characters. Like, right. They have more to offer. Okay, so she's doing that. So... The you know, the movie's kind of opens up in a marketplace in Africa, and very, very quickly the first action scene happens, and like it's pretty much a direct ripoff of the basket game, I call it, from Raiders of the Lost Ark, where they're running through the streets and Karen Allen hides in the basket and then gets taken off, you know, by the bad guys and stuff. It's very, very similar, except a carpet replaces the basket. So that's all going on. Pretty entertaining action scene, though. But I'm like, okay, so this is totally, totally, blatantly, unapologetically ripping off Raiders of the Lost Ark, which I kind of remembered. And I'm like, okay, but it felt a little more entertaining to me this time. Then the racism started, and I'm like... I did not remember this at all, but this is a racist movie. Like, bad. Like, in the first few minutes, Chamberlain calls someone a towel head, and Stone calls someone a camel jockey. So I'm like, wow. Like, this is, like, totally inappropriate, and I don't even understand how this wasn't inappropriate then. Probably was, but I was like, holy fuck. So, and yeah, and then just major racial stereotypes throughout the whole movie. Now, it is a product of the 80s, so... You know, you know, it was a different time, right? So, whatever. Okay, so then there's some, you know, it gets a little ridiculous, but I was actually pretty entertained by Chamberlain and by the action. And the one thing I will say about this movie is it doesn't really, like, the action doesn't stop. It pretty much goes from one action set piece to the next one, to the next one, to the next one. And I wasn't bored at all, but it's very derivative. Like, the next scene after the whole marketplace part is on a train. And what does Chamberlain do pretty quickly into the action scene? He goes under the train and pulls himself along underneath, just like Indiana Jones did in Raiders, under the truck. So everything kind of feels like a lift of Raiders. It's also full of, like, totally inexplicable shit. Like, Sharon Stone at one point ends up getting in a plane, and she's screaming and not knowing what she's doing. But somehow she's able to fucking make the plane take off and then fly it. Like, I don't understand how the writing even works in this movie, but those types of things happen. There's a lot of rear projection in the movie, so it's really cheesy and cheap. There's a totally ridiculous scene where they're captured by natives and put in, like, literally a giant cauldron.
Oh, that's this one. Okay, I remember
that. And they're, like, and then they, like, have sex. Like, it's implied that they have sex in the giant cauldron, or they at least make out a bit. There's a scene with this tribe of upside down people, which is really bizarre. There's quicksand. There's a gator pit. There's a
fucking really cheap ass looking giant spider. There's a room where it's a spiked ceiling that comes down. So I actually gotta say, I kind of had fun with this time, and I don't know why, because I really didn't like it. Now I think it's because I was such a huge Indiana Jones fan that I was kind of expecting, kind of like High Road to China, kind of like Treasure of the Four Crowns. I wanted another Indiana Jones movie, and none of them lived up to it. And this was in the mix. But looking at it now as like a cheesy, canon, inappropriate movie, it actually was kind of fun, I gotta say. And John Rhys Davis is even in this.
Fuck him.
Sala from
You
Raiders.
Want to talk about Mr. Paycheck? Let's talk about John Rhys Davis.
Totally. And he's the bad guy in this. It's also got Herbert Lom, who was the Phantom of the Opera in the Hammer version. And he was also in all the Pink Panther movies. It's also got Ken Gampu. Now you're like, who the fuck's Ken Gampu, Josh? And he plays like the lead, one of the lead, like kind of black characters in this movie, who's buddies with Richard Chamberlain. Ken Gampu was the lead guy in the South African movie Soul Patrol that I reviewed on the VHS Adventures a while ago. That was one of the first ones I did, actually. But it was really weird seeing him, because he's like this like pretty cool like reporter guy in Soul Patrol, a.k.a. What is the a.k.a. of that movie? Death of a Snowman. And yeah, and then it was weird seeing him as this like stereotypical native dude in this. But, you know, as much as inappropriate as it was and as racist as it was, it definitely was a lot more fun than I had remembered, you know. And if you can kind of overlook that stuff as a period of the time, and it's really that one scene where it's really, really bad near the beginning. But after that, if you can kind of overlook it, it's actually kind of fun.
Is it fun enough to watch the sequel?
I'm going to watch the sequel. Fuck yeah.
You have the sequel?
I do have the sequel.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. I had to get this from the UK. It's kind of hard to get over here now, but I ordered a UK import of the DVD, and it was only like £5 or it's like 10 bucks. It was pretty cheap. But I was looking into the like making of the movie, and there was a big controversy about how they were exploiting like the Africans and stuff. It's like pretty crazy. And but with Sharon Stone, apparently she was so horrible on this movie that like crew members were like pissing in her bathtub in her trailer and stuff because they didn't like her. And yeah, it sounded like she was just incorrigible. So I don't know what was going on with that, and I haven't, but I'm definitely curious to, I think the making of this would be a real story. So it's too bad there's not a commentary on the DVD, but I know Olive Films put out this on Blu-ray recently as well, but
there, it's Olive, there'll be nothing on it.
There'll be nothing on it, yeah. But it's pretty entertaining. But like I said, just, you know, if you're sensitive to you know what was happening maybe in the 80s or 70s with racism, you will be, and sexism for that matter, you may be quite offended by this. But as a Indiana Jones knockoff, it's not nearly as bad as I remember it, and it's a pretty briskly paced fun movie, and the action sequences are done pretty well. So that's King Solomon's Mines from 1985.
So speaking of sexism, let's talk about a movie that I watched from 2014, a Canadian film called The Scare House, which has a very, very, not very well disguised line of sexism running through the whole thing, but is mostly an entirely woman cast, was co-written and co-produced by the star of the film and directed by her husband. So the actress's name is Sarah Booth. The director is Gavin Michael Booth. What The Scare House is it's a sorority sisters kind of movie. So it's about some sorority girls who set up a haunted house, like a scare house, at Halloween time. And all the sorority sisters show up and they decide to go all fucking hostile on them because they're out for revenge for something that happened a couple years ago. So they're basically just getting them to come to the scare house, and then putting them on these saw-like torture devices and while calling them cunts over and over again.
Really?
And basically treating them like they hate women, which makes me wonder if the director and his wife do hate women, because there was a really big streak of misogyny running through this whole movie that I was shocked
really?
To see in a 2014 movie.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was pretty blatantly bad and obvious in this, and I was like, if you're trying to do this for shock factor, you should maybe rethink. You should have rethought that in the scripting stage, because it's just making you look like an asshole, to be honest.
Yeah.
Like, it really is. So this is a torture porn movie. It's the two girls in it, Elena and Corey, played by Sarah Booth and Kimberly Sue Murray, are the ones who are kidnapped, basically getting the girls to the scare host and then torturing them. There's like a scene where they like chain this chick who thinks she's too fat up to a girdle that rips her apart. They cut out one girl's implants. It's like they go for this over the top gore doesn't really work. I just thought plot wise, I mean, they tried to tie it all together at the end, but I felt it was underdeveloped for the most part, because you've got this grimy, like, we're being really nasty and mean spirited to these girls. We're calling them fucking names all the time and being really bad to them. But then we're going to interspace that with like found footage looking stuff where it's like handheld camera work of all the girls having fun at the sorority house and getting ready to party and all this stuff. And I'm just like, this tonal shift you're doing where you're trying to balance it isn't working at all. And, you know, I know you're trying to build some form of a story by doing this, which we find out later, but it does not work.
Right.
You've got a horror movie that's trying to be a torture porn horror movie, and you're putting in all this stuff with stereotypical sorority girls giggling to each other and being like, oh my God, and all that stuff. It does not work.
Yeah.
You cannot have that balance. And, you know, I just disliked the usage of the mean-spiritedness towards all the females in the cast. I just was like, I just found it really odd, considering that it's a female-backed film for the most part. And I thought the story was vague. I thought the attempts at humor didn't work. I was disconnected from most of this movie, because I got really upset at this movie early on.
Yeah.
For the way it was what kind of tone it was trying to go for, and it never recovered for me from that. And which was weird, because like I didn't mind the two lead actresses, like the villain actresses. I thought they were pretty good. Like, I thought they had some moments where they were like being that sarcastic serial killer type characters.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was like, that's okay. But if you didn't balance that with you calling everyone a cunt every 2 seconds, I might have been more on board with you. But instead, you're just being a fucking vile people to everybody. And you're just, I don't know. It's hard to justify it wanting to be a fun kind of torture horror movie when it's so mean. It's such a mean spirited movie, and weird. I don't really like that in my horror movies that much. I can take some of it, but when it just goes all out mean spirited, I don't like it. I mean, the last third does try to justify what these girls are doing, but what it all boils down to is that they're unlikable, unsympathetic characters.
Yeah,
so don't try and build them up to get the audience on their side, when all they've been doing through the whole movie is basically calling girls names and doing horrible things to them. I'm not going to get on their side. They're fucking psychotic. You know, no, I'm not going to get on their side. Don't try and get me on their side.
Yeah.
So, I think there could have been some potential there, because I liked the lead actresses. There were a few gore gags that were okay, and a couple of quote lines that I thought were pretty funny, but it's just the tone and everything just took me out of it, and I really didn't like the scare house that much.
It could have had potential, because it took place in a fucking funhouse.
Exactly.
Of course.
And they didn't really play with that much.
Yeah, that's what I thought this was. Like, I thought this was going to be like a slasher movie in a haunt.
No, it's basically they get them in the haunt, And before anyone has a chance to really do anything in the haunt, like they take like 5 steps in the haunt, the girls come and whisk them away to their room where they're going to torture them.
Yeah.
And I'm just like,
that's really disappointing.
You know, I've seen Hostel. I've seen Saw. I don't need to see a version of that where you're being more female centric, especially when your female characters are being more sexist than and more misogynistic than any male killer I've seen in these type of movies in the past.
Yeah.
So yeah.
Weird.
It was pretty disappointing.
All right.
Yep.
Wow, we're on a fucking roll.
Well, my last one, I have one left, and my last one's a good one, so.
Okay. All right, so my next one is... oh, boy, Josh. Okay, so I noticed in the last month that we lost an actress that's been in some pretty great 80s movies, and that's Darlan Flugel.
Yep.
She was in... To Live and Die in L.A., and as well as some other...
Maniac Cop, I believe.
Was she in Maniac Cop?
I think she might be. I'll have to look it up.
I know she was in Running Scared and some other movies, but she was pretty good. I mean, I remembered her from those movies for sure, and but I didn't know she had starred in this one. So I'm like, okay, I'll check this out. Kino Lorber put this out, so I'm like, okay, Kino Lorber is solid, so... the Kino Lorber Studio Classics line in particular, everything I've watched there has been great, so I decided to go for it. It's directed by, from 1988, directed by Francis Delia.
And Freeway. Freeway.
Freeway, yeah. And I didn't, you know, didn't I mention the title yet? Yeah, it's called Freeway.
You didn't mention the title, I guess.
Okay,
it.
Directed by Francis Delia. We'll get back to him in a sec. He hasn't really directed... any other features, really. So it stars Darlan Flugel. She's a widow. Her husband was killed by this dude who drives along the freeways in L.A. killing other drivers with a gun. And I'm like, okay, I kind of remember this from the 80s. I do remember freeway killings being a thing. So this was obviously trying to cash in on that. Yeah. She was great. Like, I've always thought she's had, in the movies I've seen her in, she's always had screen presence. She's beautiful. And I feel like she can carry a movie, and she does. She was great in this. So there's nothing bad about her. And she died really young, man. Like, she died, like, in her 50s, I believe, like, in December. It's pretty sad. But early onset Alzheimer's. I always find that to be totally tragic. We've talked about Alzheimer's before. When we were talking about Taking of Deborah Logan.
Yeah.
So she's all bummed out because her husband got killed. So she's still trying to figure out what happened to him. So she gets into a bit of trouble. She gets into a car accident. She ends up going to a garage and meeting a really creepy Clint Howard.
When is Clint Howard not creepy?
He's like extra creepy in this one. So he's a really kind of sleazy garage owner. And this is where I'm like, okay, this is kind of a weird, this has got a weird tone to it. And he's like, you know, he's like, yeah, just really creepy. And for whatever reason, he doesn't have loaner cars. So he gives her his like, vintage Camaro that's a really sweet car and lets her drive it, and I'm like, okay, so this is kind of off, it's not really making a lot of sense, but whatever, she's cool, so I'll watch her. Okay, then soon after that she runs into James Russo. Now James Russo's character actor, he's been in tons of shit. This is a very early role for him. He's playing a cop that's, I think he's a cop turned bounty hunter. He had, you know, I don't know if he got kicked off the force, but he's now a bounty hunter. He's kind of like the badass cop, but he's got that, he's really, really trying to be cool in this. And it really, really doesn't work. Like, he's got that, like, yeah, I'm really cool. Like, that kind of voice. Kind of like Dylan on 90210. That's who he reminded me of. If Dylan became a cop, but wasn't really very cool anymore. I always thought Dylan was kind of cool. Anyways, James Russo in this was not. It didn't work at all. I was really kind of weird watching, because you're like, I know he thinks he's being really cool, but it's really not working at all. And then they develop a relationship very quickly. And I always, that always kind of bothers me in movies when two characters that don't really seem that into each other are all of a sudden kind of in love and like making big sacrifices for the other person that they met like 3 hours ago.
Yeah.
I never really understand. And I do find that that's a plot device that's used way too much. Like, you need to have some sort of history or some sort of reason why someone's willing to risk their life for someone they met 3 hours
ago. It happens a lot in action movies and thrillers.
Yeah, yeah. And it does not work in this at all. We've got Richard Belzer from Law and Order, SVU. I think he was on the first Law and Order as well. He's been around lots. He's playing a radio DJ, like kind of like a talk radio type DJ, like a late night guy, or I think he's early morning. But anyway, for some, whatever reason, the freeway killer is calling him all the time, so he's trying to bring him down. And it's also got Billy Drago in it. And Billy Drago is usually pretty entertaining, and he does what he's supposed to do here, but doesn't really save it. It's got a lot of like weird montages of like the freeway killer like killing people, and they're directed really like they're trying to be stylish, but again not working at all. It felt like it was a New Horizons movie that felt like it was trying to be a Michael Mann movie but failing.
I thought it was New World.
New World, yeah.
Yeah.
But it was a low-budget movie that I think was... It really felt like it was trying to have that Michael Mann vibe to it. And I think part of the reason for that is Francis Delia had directed some episodes of Crime Story, which was the Michael Mann, one of a TV series he did in the 80s. But yeah, just not working at all. Now, Francis Delia, now this line should tell you everything about this movie. Francis Delia, I think his top credit other than this movie is that fucking We Built This City rock video.
Oh no!
By Starship. Yeah, so I'm like, okay.
I'm selling my Blu-ray of this movie before I even open it now.
As soon as I saw that, I'm like, ah, now I know what happened.
Fucking sorry, Freeway, I'm not opening you now. You, the directors involved in Starship, it can fuck off out of my collection.
Just to defend this guy a little bit, he also directed the Mexican radio video by Wall of Voodoo. Not that that's really helping that much. He also directed the A Million Miles Away video by the Plimsolls. So he worked with some cool bands as well. Well, but nothing can forgive him for directing the We Built the City video. Not only is it one of the worst songs ever recorded,
it's one
of the worst videos ever made.
Ugh.
Kind of told me everything I needed to know about this. Unfortunately, you're right. Like, this movie is the first Kino Lorber Studio Classics movie that I'm like, yeah, I don't need to keep this. So this is the first one I'll be getting rid of. Because I thought this line was so solid, I thought I'd be keeping literally everything I bought from this line. But this one was a stinker, big time. And I won't go back to this ever. Like, this was not well done. Now, as a fan of Darlan Flugel, I could see watching this because she does have the lead role. But that's about all I could recommend about this movie. Is if you like her, maybe you'll get a bit out of it because of that. But it's just not a well-made movie. It's just boring and trying to be stylish but not really succeeding. So you bought this, eh?
Yeah, I did buy this.
I mean, when you look at the cast, you're like Richard Belzer, Darlan Flugel.
It was actually Billy Drago that made
Billy
me buy
Drago
it.
And James Russo, and I'm like, oh, this is gonna be great. No, it's not. So that's Freeway, not to be confused with the awesome Freeway directed by Matthew Bright.
Well, the thing is, too, about this Freeway is that I remember seeing the trailer for it all the time on the New World VHS releases when I was younger.
I didn't know anything about it until
And I had never rented it, but I remember seeing the trailer all the time in front of all the New World movies, and I was like, ooh, Freeway. So then when it came out on Blu-ray, and then I was like, oh, Billy Drago, I was like, I'm in. So.
Well, it's interesting because I thought it was pretty terrible, but when I did go on Letterboxd and even IMDb, I did find like the ratings were, you know, pretty average, but I did find people giving this pretty good reviews. So maybe I'm totally missing something, but I thought it was super lame.
Well, I'm just upset that now Starship has been mentioned on our last two episodes in a row.
Was it mentioned in the last
one? Mannequin, dude.
Oh, yeah.
So we got to stop this shit. Starship cannot be infecting our brains any more than they need to be. I'm sorry.
Yeah, like, seriously. I never thought in my life, who directed We Built This City? Now I know.
Good on you.
Yeah, so that's Freeway from 1980.
All right, so my last movie is a movie that ties into my movie resolution that I did on the recap episode where I said, I'm going to start watching movies that I've never seen before. I'm going to not be afraid to watch movies. So I decided this year I'm going to watch movies that are considered classics, and I'm going to stick to my guns. So I decided I'd start off more on the lighter side of things. And I finally, for the first time ever, saw the 1982 movie Tootsie, directed by Sidney Pollack.
Oh, what a letdown.
I know. Sorry. I know
I was
you don't
like, what did he watch?
I know you don't like this movie, I don't think.
I just don't remember it.
Yeah, anyway.
I don't like, we've talked about, I don't like the whole dressing up as women
thing. So the basis of this movie is that Dustin Hoffman plays like a struggling actor. He's like, he does acting classes. He's good at his craft, but nobody wants to hire him because he just doesn't have what they're looking for, basically. So he's a struggling New York actor. His roommate's played by Bill Murray, who is amazing, by the way. And he decides that his friend, played by Terry Garr, gets rejected from the soap opera. So he's like, you know what? I'm going to go to this audition. I'm going to dress myself up as a female. I'm going to go to this audition, and I'm going to see if I can get this part. Well, he does get this part on this cheesy, hospital-based soap opera, which co-stars Jessica Lange's character and a character played by George Gaines, a horny old doctor played by George Gaines, who I basically only knew as Commandant Lassard in the Police Academy movies.
It always comes back to Police Academy.
But in this movie, he's such a pervy doctor who, as an actor, he just wants to try and kiss all the actresses as part of the scene because he's such a pervert.
Yeah.
Jessica Lange plays like the hot young nurse on the soap opera who Dustin Hoffman kind of falls for and wants to like befriends, and you know, they're having their girl bonding moments, but secretly he wants, you know, to her to fall in love with him, but he's like, I'm a girl, I can't get her to do that, and so on and so forth. It also brings in the messages about, you know, there's a lot of like kind of feminist friendly messages in this, because Dabney Coleman plays your typical asshole sexist boss like he did in 9 to 5.
Yeah,
another classic from the early 80s here. And you know, he's good at this. He's good at being a sexist fucking asshole.
Yeah.
And he plays it perfectly in this movie. And it's basically a war of wills between him and the Dustin Hoffman character, who's always fighting with him and always, you know, improvising on set and saying, you can't treat me like that because I'm a woman and all this stuff, when really he's not a woman. And he's got that issue because he's trying to fall in love with Jessica Lange.
Yeah.
And meanwhile, his roommate Bill Murray is off to the side saying, you're crazy, dude. Like, why are you doing this? And then his friend Terry Garr, who has feelings for him, keeps getting pushed aside and getting upset at him because he wants Jessica Lange.
Right.
So it's kind of a romantic comedy mixed with a satire, mixed with, you know, just like some mild feminist messages. And it's a pretty fun movie, I gotta admit. Like, I did enjoy myself. I did find some of the lines to be really good. There's a lot of quotable lines in this. Bill Murray, like I said, is awesome. Dustin Hoffman, I've always liked Dustin Hoffman. And, you know, he makes an ugly woman, admittedly. But I did like him in the movie. I thought he was fine. Jessica Lange, this is early work for her. I've always liked Jessica Lange.
Yeah.
And in this one, she's actually really good. She actually won an Oscar for this movie.
Is it the only Oscar this one?
Yeah, it was nominated for 10 Oscars.
Yeah.
And Jessica Lange's the only one who actually won one.
Huh.
So I was just stunned that this movie was nominated for 10 Oscars.
Yeah.
You do not see comedies being nominated for any Oscars these days.
I feel like this was up for Best Picture that
year. It was.
Yeah.
Best Picture, Best Screenplay, Best Director, Best Actor, Best Actress, Best Supporting.
Wow.
It was up for so much stuff. Best Song, Best Cinematography. It was up for so much stuff.
Hmm.
And she's the only thing that won. But this was one of those ones where I'm like, okay, it's on Criterion. It's considered to be a comedy classic. It's on one of the movie channels I have. I'm going to finally watch this. Because it's, you know, 35 years old.
Yeah.
And I've never seen it. So I was like, this is a good starting point for my series of I'm going to watch these things that I've never seen.
Yeah.
Because it's not going to be something that's going to be taxing, because it's not going to be super serious. I know that going in. And, you know, and if I come out of it, if I come out of it enjoying myself, then I've found a comedy that I liked. Because comedies are, it's hard for me with modern comedies to be pleased with, because they're just raunchiness and stuff, right?
Yeah.
Whereas with this movie, it was more, you know, more subtle humor and more dialogue driven and character driven. And I liked it. I thought it was a fun movie. I wouldn't say it's worthy of being nominated for Best Picture, admittedly, but it's got a great cast. Like I said, lots of quotable lines, and it's just a really fun movie. So, yeah, Tootsie, I was glad I saw it, finally, 35 years later.
Are you going to pick up the Criterion disc?
I probably won't buy it.
Yeah.
But, I mean, I did enjoy my time with it.
Nice.
I mean, okay. Out of all the five movies I talked about here, Spider-Man Homecoming is obviously the one I enjoyed the most.
Yeah.
But at least I did enjoy something else.
Yeah.
Because the other three, yeah, not so much.
All right.
Josh's VHS Adventures!
Yes, and what an adventure this was.
I feel like you say that every week.
Okay, this is the obscurest of the obscure. And I've been putting this one off.
Is it more obscure than Game of Survival, directed by Armin Gazarian?
This is pretty fucking obscure.
All right.
Okay, this is one of the... Do you remember that Rogers Video First Rights line?
Yeah, they had Massacre Up North and The Widower.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The Widower. That's what I watched.
Oh, The Widower. Okay. Yeah. This is the one with, like, Jello Biafra, isn't it?
So, yeah. It's yeah, okay. On the back, it says, special appearance by Jello Biafra from the Dead Kennedys. So I'm like, okay. It's a quirky little movie, Canadian movie. So First Rights was a series of video VHS that were released, I think, in the 90s.
Yeah.
Late by 90s. A big video chain up here, and they put out an independent feature every month, I believe, of some movie that probably wouldn't have gotten distribution otherwise. And then it went out to all the Rogers Video locations across Canada. So this is a movie from 1999, directed by Marcus Rogers. Hasn't done a lot more. He hasn't done any other feature films, but we're going to get back to him in a second. So Biafra is only in this for a few scenes near the beginning. He plays a weird funeral parlor owner. And he's pretty entertaining at this. Biafra was in, you know, he popped up in the occasional Canadian movie back in the day. He was in Highway 61, or was he in Highway 61 or Roadkill, one of those. And he popped up in the Terminal City Ricochet. He was in there. But the premise of this movie is we've got this guy named Milton, and he's an old man, and his wife has passed away, but he hasn't really reported that she's died. She fell in the bathtub and died by hitting her head. And anyway, he's decided he's just going to keep the corpse in the house. So he has propped the corpse up on the couch, and, you know, he goes to work and comes home and talks to the corpse and changes her and has dinner and with her and stuff and talks to her lots. And so it's pretty eccentric. And then, you know, like, there's more going on. It's not just him sitting there talking to a corpse for 90 minutes. We've got, you know, the nosy neighbor across the hall who's rear window style, like looking into the room and seeing this guy with his corpse. And, you know, she calls the cops, and we've got this like pair of like bumbling gay cops who are, you know, investigating, but they're terrible at their job. And then we've got Milton, who, you know, decides to take the corpse out for little excursions. So they go to the beach at one point, and they go to a bar at one point, and it's pretty weird.
It's like Weekend at Bernie's, only darker.
But it's pretty funny. Like, it was, because I kept putting this one off. I didn't like the cover, and I'm like, oh man, this is gonna be shitty. So I'm not, you know. And then finally, you know, I'm just like, okay, fuck it, I'll just watch it. I don't know what else to watch. I'll just go to grab the first thing I saw. And yeah, it held my interest for sure. I didn't really like Milton that much, but he did what he was supposed to do. Now, the thing that makes this pretty entertaining is
I mean, as you know, I'm a big fan of the Vancouver music scene. I used to be involved in it. I am a big fan of Vancouver punk rock. So I didn't know this was shot in Vancouver. So you get a lot of like late 90s Vancouver locations, which is pretty fun. We have the early appearance by Jello Biafra. His assistant in the funeral is played by Annie Kidd. She was an Alternative Tentacles recording artist for a while. She also played bass for Thor. So I recognized her and I'm like, where do I know her from? And I'm like, she was in Thor. Joey Shithead or Joe Keithley from DOA shows up as a bartender. Nardwar, the human serviette, shows up as a donut shop guy and who works at a donut shop that I know quite well that's still in existence now. Now, if you don't know Nardwar, I'm just going to give a little plug to Nardwar. If you're not familiar with him, he's kind of a Vancouver fixture, but he does interviews with famous people. Do you know Nardwar? Have you seen his stuff?
Yep.
Yeah. So I'd recommend checking him out on YouTube. He does some pretty entertaining interviews with famous rock and rollers.
The thing about him is that he always manages to come up with stuff that stuns the interview topics.
Yeah.
Like he comes up with information. You're like, where the hell did he get that from?
Yeah. He's incredibly, incredibly knowledgeable on rock and roll in general. Like Chris said, like I remember there was one with David Grohl, I believe, or was it? No, it was Duff McKagan. And like Nardwar was like whipping out pictures and like records, like that Duff McKagan's like, where the hell did this come from? But all kinds of them. He interviewed Kurt Cobain. He interviewed Sonic Youth is a very famous one. So yeah, check him out on YouTube, Nardwar the Human Serviette.
Yeah, they're a lot of fun.
Yeah. Anyway, he pops up for a few minutes. But then I started noticing the soundtrack and, you know, I heard No Means No was on there. And then there's one scene where they're in the bar and there's a flashback sequence that happens where Milton originally met his wife. And the band that's playing, I'm like, fuck, this band's really good. Turns out it's this band called Cole, who I really liked back then. They're kind of like a loungy, kind of a gothy, torchlighty band that they put out a few records on. They had a few albums come out, and I really, really liked them. One of the things that I really liked by them is they did a really good cover of Ace of Spades by Motorhead in their style, which was really cool. But as I was looking into it further, it turns out that Marcus Rogers, the director of this movie, is the bass player from Cole, which explains why they were in it so much. But for me, being a big fan of Vancouver music, it was really fun seeing all these things popping up and listening to the soundtrack and hearing all these, you know, the Smugglers are on it. Like all these bands that I know were on this. And I'm really surprised that this has like slipped by my radar all these years. So not knowing any of this and watching this and having this all being revealed as it was coming up was really, really cool to me. So this might just be a totally regional thing, but I really enjoyed this. And, you know, it's really quirky. And, I mean, I think the weak link was Milton, but, overall, it was a pretty fun little movie, and Marcus Rogers has done some other. He's done a lot of music videos and that type of thing, but never another feature. But yeah, kind of a cool little surprise. Anyway, so it's called The Widower from 1999.
Josh's VHS Adventures.
Yeah.
All right. So let's dive into buddy action movies.
Yeah.
So we were talking a little bit beforehand that we what were our guidelines? We left out like partners, because remember we were talking about like,
well, it could be a partner,
well, it could be a partner, but you were kind of talking like, well, I wanted to put the French Connection on here, but they're not really buddies, they're partners. And what was the other movie you were saying, like Busting?
Yeah,
you're like, they're not really buddies, they're partners. Whereas a movie like Lethal Weapon, which is not on my list because I excluded it on purpose, they're technically partners, but I found that to be a buddy movie because they do become friends and they do hang out with each other. Mel Gibson's character hangs out with Danny Glover's family at times in the movie, and they don't like each other at first, but then they learn to like each other.
Well, and I think that's the difference is they learned they have to like work together when they don't really get along, and that's the thing. Like French Connection. Yeah, although they have different styles, they're partners. Like they know what they're doing. Like it's not like they're like playing off. Like it's not like it's like a jokey thing. It's like they're just partners and they're good at it. And, but they don't really have to come together. Like they're already together. Same with busting. Like those guys, they're already together. We don't need to like, that relationship isn't the centerpiece of the movie.
So basically what my guideline was a little bit was that for the most part, my movies are where two people who shouldn't really get along are thrown together in a situation that involves a whole bunch of stuff blowing up and lots of guns firing and stuff like that, basically. That's what my guidelines were going in.
I went in a different direction. I still went with the two people not getting along angle, but I think mine might be a little more serious.
Mine's a little less serious. But I just wanted to say that I purposely left off two movies, and I know you said they weren't on yours either. I purposely left out Lethal Weapon.
Yeah.
And I purposely left out 48 Hours with Nick Nolte and Eddie Murphy, because I find that any conversation that's about these kind of movies is going to include those two movies, because they are the torchbearers of these kind of movies. So I love both of those movies. I just didn't want to put them on my list because they are the ones that everyone looks at and says, these are the two movies that started this trend. So that's why I left them off.
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean,
Yeah, I wanted to kind of shine the light on some movies. You like, we're only listing five movies, so rather than be like, oh, my number one is Lethal Weapon and my number two is 48 Hours, I want to shine the light on other buddy movies that I really love that I feel like some people might not know about. But don't get me wrong, all five of the movies that are on my list, I love every single one of them.
Yeah, and I felt the same way. Like, I just felt like if we, and it's, I'm glad we did decide that, because I just felt like if you're doing a top five, for sure 48 Hours would have been on both of ours.
Yeah.
And the first Lethal Weapon probably as well. At least one of us would have mentioned
it. I would have had it, for sure.
So, so from that perspective, I agree that, you know, they're just too obvious.
Okay. So I've got, should we just, should we jump into our list, or should I just mention a couple of movies I wanted to talk about?
I think we should do our list first, just in case the other person has any honorable mentions. Okay, and then
at the end we'll do it. Okay, so let's, I ranked mine as usual.
Oh, God damn it.
You don't have to have ranked yours. You can just go off the cuff.
No, I'm going to go off the cuff. I didn't rank mine.
All right. So do you want, should you, you can start this since I started the What Have You Been Watching.
Okay.
So what's your first
choice? My first is a tie. I just honestly couldn't pick between the two, but they're
you let me get away with it once, so I'll let you get away
with
it.
Well, they're okay, no, I'll just pick one.
No, just do it both. Come on.
Okay, they're both John Woo movies.
Okay.
One's called The Killer, one's called Hard Boiled.
Okay.
So The Killer,
pretty easy to see why they would tie.
Yeah. So The Killer is from 1989. It's a story of a hitman who blinds a he's doing a hit and ends up blinding a singer in the process, and then ends up kind of taking care of her while also doing his hitman stuff. But the buddy aspect is that there's a cop tracking him, played by Danny Lee. And I really like the chemistry of these guys, because it does play into that, in that we've got a hitman, we've got a cop tracking him, and then they have to come together during the movie and battle evil, basically.
Yeah.
And boy, do they battle evil. And like, and I thought they played really well off each other. Like, you really, like, Chow Yun-Fat plays the hitman, and he's pretty cool. And, but Danny Lee, you can really see the struggle of him, like, seeing Chow Yun-Fat kind of taking care of this blind woman and really kind of struggling with that. And then when he does decide he has to help Chow, it really works. And they just, again, it's a John Woo movie, at John Woo's peak, and just the gunplay and the action sequences and seeing these guys like fighting together is pretty awesome to see. And the reason I threw Hard Boiled in as well is because it's kind of the opposite of that. In this one, Chow's playing a cop named Tequila. And his foil is, or his, sorry, quote unquote buddy is a mafia guy played by Tony Leung, named Alan. And again, it's different in that Chow's the good guy in this one, and Tony Leung's the bad guy, but also they have to join forces to fight off the evil. And both are like top-notch action movies, but both have that buddy aspect. And frankly, it was kind of the first things I thought of, because in Hard Boiled, there's multiple scenes where they're both like holding guns, and we've got the back to back and stuff. Same within The Killer, and it's like that slow motion John Woo thing, and it's like, yeah, this like unlikely pair that have come together to, you know, perform some sort of task. And both really great flicks, and both that I thought were maybe a little bit outside the box,
yeah,
as far as the topic goes, but definitely fall under the topic because they're not partners.
most definitely under the radar,
but not funny. Like they're not like funny. Like, but they do have to get along like a cop, like buddy cop movies.
Yeah, I'd say off topic a little bit, but I can see where you're coming from on that. And they both are great films. If you're not familiar with the stuff John Woo was doing back in Hong Kong,
yeah,
back in the day, you need to grab these movies. That, I mean, they're easily accessible.
Or they are. And so, they're both awesome.
If you haven't seen them, if you think Chow Yun-fat, if you're just used to his American movies, no. Watch Hard Boiled and The Killer and you'll change your mind.
Yeah, I'd probably lean a little towards, if I had to pick between the two, towards Hard Boiled.
Yeah, Hard Boiled is the more mainstream, crowd-pleasing movie of the two, I think.
But The Killer's pretty great as well, especially the last sequence in that church.
They're both so great, great movies.
Yeah.
So just to prove how unserious my list is going to be jumping off of those two, my number five choice is Hot Fuzz from 2007, directed by Edgar Wright. It's a reteaming of him with his Shaun of the Dead co-stars Simon Pegg and Nick Frost.
Yeah.
It's an ode to buddy cop movies and to action movies in general, because it's got Simon Pegg playing this like by the book kind of badass, I bust the criminals kind of cop who gets like kind of demoted to this small town. And when he gets there, he's partnered up with the Nick Frost character, who's just like a bumbling kind of idiot who's like in awe of the Simon Pegg character, because he's like not a very good cop, but the Simon Pegg character is a really good cop. And they end up being thrown into the middle of this murder investigation because there's a guy in a black coat just going around murdering all the townsfolk in bloody ways. And it plays off a lot of action movie stereotypes. And it even references that. Like, one of the characters has a big movie collection of all the action movies, and they're obsessed with Point Break and the scene in Point Break where they fire their guns in the air. And he's like, does everyone do that? Have you ever fired your gun in the air? And it's got all those kind of things. And I really like movies that kind of take that kind of set stereotypes and tropes of these movies and plays with it in a fun way, but a respectful way.
Yeah.
But also manages to be its own pretty cool action movie, action slash comedy at the same time. Because I think Hot Fuzz is definitely the most underrated of all the Edgar Wright movies. Like, it's the one that I don't hear a lot of people talking about compared to like Shaun of the Dead or like, you know, Baby Driver and, you know, Scott Pilgrim and all that. No one really talks about Hot Fuzz enough. And
it's much better than Baby Driver.
It's a buddy movie through and through, Hot Fuzz.
Yeah.
And you know, it's got gore, it's got a lot of laughs, plus it's got Timothy Dalton playing a total fucking scumbag. I think he's the town mayor, but he's a total scumbag, but he's great in it. Like, I think Timothy Dalton, I'm actually kind of looking forward to when I get to the Bond Daltons, because I'm like, you never know. He's fun in everything else I've seen him in.
He's awesome in Penny Dreadful, too.
So yeah, I put Hot Fuzz because I'm like, well, I'm going to start off on a fun note. And, you know, Hot Fuzz is one of those buddy movies that nobody talks about that much, considering who made it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. I'm going to go with a bit of a controversial choice now.
Oh, yeah?
I'm going to go with Lethal Weapon 2.
Lethal Weapon 2 is pretty good.
So
I actually remember back in the day liking Lethal Weapon 2 more than Lethal Weapon.
Well, this is why I put it on my list, because I liked Lethal Weapon 2 better.
Yeah.
And it's the one I remember more.
That's the one I'm revisiting, because I just revisited the first one at Christmas time. So
yeah.
Now, this was directed by Richard Donner, who did he?
He did all four.
Yeah, okay. It reunites Riggs and Murtaugh, so Mel Gibson and Danny Glover.
Yep.
The difference is that this one brings more of a comedic element to the series than the first one did.
Well, the first one did have some comedic elements, but it had some serious stuff.
Yeah. I thought Gary Busey's character was pretty harsh in the first one.
Well, and also in the first one, the Mel Gibson character was suicidal through the whole movie, exactly. Which kind of made it a little bit more of a serious tone.
Yeah, like I felt like they went way more comedy on this one.
Yeah.
Now, the reason it's a bit controversial is because this movie, the sequel, was also written by Shane Black, who wrote the first one. But the problem is that his script was basically thrown away, and the movie was rewritten, and it went more in that comedic tone. So Shane Black fans and Shane Black himself don't like this movie, but I do. And, you know, it still had some heavy elements to it. Like, I'm not going to spoil anything, but I do remember one scene in particular that was quite shocking. But it also had a lot of fun. Like, I mean, the movie opens with Danny Glover stuck on the toilet. It's a very famous scene where Mel Gibson, and there's a bomb under the toilet, and Mel Gibson has to go into the house to save him. And yeah, it's got a lot of, it had the whole Joss Ackland playing the South African villain, you know, always screaming that he had diplomatic immunity. Yep. It's super quotable.
Diplomatic immunity.
Yeah, super, super memorable as a villain. Like, I totally stuck out to me. Patsy Kensit plays a love interest. She was kind of a big deal at the time. I haven't really heard much about her in the last 15 years.
The only thing I remember her being in apart from this was she was in, I think, that Terminal Velocity skydiving movie with Charlie Sheen, and that's really all I remember her from was those two.
Was that her and Natasha Kinski?
Was it Patsy? She was in something. Maybe I'm getting it.
I know she was in some stuff at the time.
Yeah.
And it seemed like she was going to be huge, and then just, like, I recognize the name and everything, but yeah.
Maybe I'm wrong on that. I think maybe I'm wrong. I think it was Natasha Kinski in Terminal Velocity.
Yeah, and then Joe Pesci was in this, and although, you know, I like Joe Pesci, but he is quite annoying, and this one is the start of his, you know, participation in the Lethal Weapon movies that arguably might have ruined the latter Lethal Weapon movies.
Yeah, he definitely, after this one, they played him up way too much. Yeah. I hated him in 3 and 4, but yeah. I tolerated him
he
in 2.
He was okay in this. Annoying, yeah. But, you know, it kind of added to the comedy, but he became a lot more of a central figure in the third and fourth movies. I also remember there's a, you know, very famous scene of Mel Gibson pulling down a stilt house. But yeah, it's just, I just thought this was a lot of fun. And, you know, even though it would be interesting to see what Shane Black's original script, how that would have panned out, I think it would have been a lot darker. And I think this is what really, really put Gibson and Glover as the kind of poster boys for buddy cops.
Oh, the movie I was thinking of, and I don't know why I got it confused with Terminal Velocity, is Full Eclipse with Mario Van Peebles, where they played werewolf cops.
Different.
Yeah, I don't know how I got those two confused, but that's what I was thinking of.
Yeah.
That she was in, Patsy Kensit.
Yeah, yeah. Anyway, that's it for Lethal Weapon 2.
Yeah, I remember back in the day liking Lethal Weapon 2 more than the first one, too, because it was more comedic.
Yeah.
And I am planning on revisiting the second one because I have the first two on Blu-ray.
Yeah.
And that says something that I didn't buy the box set because I remember I don't like 4 and I thought 3 wasn't that great either.
Yeah.
So that's why when they were on Blu-ray, I'm like, I'm just buying the first two.
No, I agree. I think the first two are where it's at with the Lethal Weapon. Yeah. Is there a new one coming out?
There's a TV show.
Oh, yeah. The TV show.
With like Damon Wayans and somebody else.
Yeah.
Which I've had no interest in.
Yeah.
But that's all I know. Okay. So number 4 for me. From 1988, Midnight Run.
Okay, so you're a little outside the box,
that's
too.
That's a little outside the box.
That's good.
Starring Robert De Niro and Charles Grodin.
Yeah.
Robert De Niro plays a bounty hunter who's sent in to collect Charles Grodin and take him from New York to L.A. because he's like a witness to a mob thing. And along the way, they're tailed by not only the mob, but also the FBI and another bounty hunter who wants to kidnap Charles Grodin, basically, and turn him in to get the reward, played by John Ashton, who's a great character actor.
Yeah.
This is a movie directed by Martin Brest, who also directed another great 80s action movie, which I know you don't think has held up, but I've watched recently and still love, Beverly Hills Cop.
Mm-hmm.
He also directed Scent of a Woman, and he killed his career by writing and directing 2003 Geely, starring Ben Affleck and Jennifer Lopez.
Mm.
It's the last movie he ever made because it was such a bomb.
Yeah, that's not a good track record.
Which is pretty unfortunate.
Yeah.
This also has Yaphet Kotto.
Okay.
It's got Joey Pants.
Mm-hmm.
Joey Pantolonio.
Pantoliano.
Yeah, and this movie for me was all about the chemistry.
Mm-hmm.
Because the whole movie was just De Niro and Grodin kind of bickering with each other. And Grodin was kind of the annoying one, but De Niro was so cool as the bounty hunter, he always shut him down and told him to shut up.
Yeah.
And meanwhile, they'd get in all these absurd action sequences and kept getting chased. There'd be car chases, there'd be helicopter chases. And it's just a fun movie. It's got a lot of quotable lines, just like Hot Fuzz did. The two leads are great. Like Charles Grodin, I'm hit or miss on.
Yeah.
And this is De Niro before he kind of became, honestly, the kind of jokey is now being in comedies. Like, this is De Niro doing comedy proper before he kind of...
Before the, you know, Ben Stiller face.
Bad Grandpa and all that stuff.
The,
you know, this is
Meet the Fockers. And
this
all
is when I could buy De Niro doing comedy, whereas I couldn't buy it after this. And really, the only other thing I have to add about this movie, because if you haven't seen Midnight Run, you should check it out. It's one of those great late 80s action comedies. They did make three made-for-TV sequels starring Chris McDonald that you should pretty much avoid, but if you're like me, you're an idiot. You went and bought the DVD set that has the original movie and the three sequels
Chris
on
McDonald,
it.
Like from Happy Gilmore? That guy?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
He takes the De Niro character. He takes up for the De Niro character.
Oh.
Yeah. So,
oh, really?
It's kind of a step down from De Niro to Chris McDonald, I gotta admit.
Yeah, no kidding.
But yeah, Midnight
you
Run.
You bought those?
I bought it because it has the original movie and the three sequels. It cost me $10.
Oh, dude.
I wanted the original.
$10 and 6 hours of your life.
But dude, I paid $10 for Midnight Run. The sequels were just bonus features.
Yeah.
So that's the way I looked at it. So Midnight Run's a great movie. You should check it out if you haven't seen it.
Yeah, no, I remember it being pretty fun. Yeah, for sure. Okay. My next choice is
controversial as well. No.
Probably. Is 1995 Seven, directed by
this one was borderline
David
for me.
Fincher.
This was really borderline for me. I almost did it, but then I was like, I don't know. I was heading more for the action.
Yeah, and I know, like, and I figured you'd be going a little more light.
Yeah.
And I'm going a little more dark.
Yeah.
But
I definitely went a lot more light.
Yeah, the reason I picked Seven is just because, again, it really kind of, I felt, fit in with the whole, and this to me is a buddy cop in that, in a more literal sense, in that it's two cops who, like, we've got Morgan Freeman, who's like the old cop who's, you know, been on the force for years. He's approaching retirement. He's pretty by the book. And then the other cop is played by Brad Pitt, who's new on the force, who's kind of a loose cannon, doesn't play by the rules, but they eventually literally become buddies. And so I was taking it quite literally that way, but it does fit all the tropes of the genre in that they do have to learn how to work together. Even though they've got totally different styles. The only thing missing is the comedy. But I kind of like it in that it does take away the comedy, and it does kind of show that this probably could happen in real life in a way. And the chemistry between these two guys, I mean, I think this is when they were both at the top of their game. Everyone in this movie is at the top of their... I mean, this movie is like a 5 out of 5. I mean, there's nothing wrong with this movie. And even though Kevin Spacey's in it, he's awesome.
He is awesome.
There's nothing wrong with this movie. It's pretty much perfect.
also has Arlie Ermey, John C. McGinley, Gwyneth Paltrow, Richard Roundtree, Shaft himself shows up. And, I mean, I don't know if I really need to go through the plot of Seven. I mean, this is a dark, dark police procedural about these two guys trying to catch this killer who's murdering people in the, you know, going through the seven deadly sins in quite an elaborate manner. And it's very gritty. It's very gory, and it's
very dark
and dark and intense and and really fucking good. But I did feel like it did fit in the genre, just again in a bit more of a non-traditional way, but more of a realistic way. I mean, these guys aren't really cracking jokes, but they do connect. And I think this whole genre is about connection, and usually in a comedic way. I just thought I'd throw this in because it's in a different way. Kind of like the John Woo movies too, right? But even those feel like a little more fun. But this felt a little more real. And it's just such a great movie. And I was kind of like, where else am I going to bring up Seven? So it felt like a good place to bring it up.
Well, to be honest with you, it crossed my mind also. Okay. But like you... Like you were saying, I went more with the comedic,
mm-hmm.
action-y side of things because I was like, well, you know, I might get to talk about Seven eventually when we talk about, like, you know, serial killer movies or something like that. And,
yeah.
But I see where you're coming from because it did cross my mind, too. I was like, well, Seven's a buddy movie in a roundabout way.
Yeah.
So, yeah. No, that's an interesting choice, and I'm glad you put it on there because I almost did.
Well, and the other thing, and just to defend my position a little bit more, too, is I haven't seen, like, I've seen some buddy cop movies. Like, I've seen quite a few buddy cop movies, but just not a lot that I would put on my top five.
Right.
I mean, earlier today you said, well, you could have put The Last Boy Scout. Yeah, The Last Boy Scout is a buddy action movie, but... certainly not something I would put on a top five of anything.
Right.
Like, it was fun, but not top five. So, and that's kind of how I feel about a lot of them, the ones I've seen. And then aside from those, there's other ones I've seen that it's been too long and I just didn't feel comfortable. And I'm sure you're going to bring a couple of them up.
Yeah, that'll be after my list. I have a couple.
Yeah. And even they might be on your list, but there's a couple I thought of where I'm like, okay, I think this would probably be on my list. But I literally haven't seen it in 20 years. So I'm like, I just don't feel good about putting that on my list. So, but ones like Seven and The Killer, I mean, I know for sure that I love those movies. And I still feel like they fit the genre.
All right.
Okay.
So my third one is one that's pretty obvious to Josh.
Right.
Because he knows me. And he knows that I love me some James Glickenhaus.
Yeah.
And this is a 1988 movie called what, Josh?
Stakeout?
Shakedown, starring Peter Weller and
I always get those two
Sam Elliott.
Yeah.
So
is coming out from?
It's coming out next week.
Shout Select.
From Shout
right?
Select. Yeah. I already pre-ordered it.
Right. You bring it over tonight? Was it in the?
Yeah.
Was it in the box?
Yeah, it was, dude. It was in the box of DVDs I dropped off at your house.
Yeah, yeah, okay.
I'm like your dealer. I've just come over randomly with boxes of DVDs. Well,
when I saw that one, I'm like, I'm watching the shit out of that because that's exactly what I was just talking about. Probably would have been on my list. Haven't seen it since the 80s. Yeah.
I have.
Yeah.
I've seen this movie 10 plus times.
Wow.
So James Glickenhaus, if you don't know, was a badass kind of action movie director in the 80s. You know, he started out, he did like The Exterminator, he did what's that movie with Ken Wall, The Soldier, which is coming out on Blu-ray
the
soon.
Protector,
he did Jackie The Protector Chan. With Jackie Chan, which Jackie Chan admittedly doesn't like, and he made Slaughter of the Innocents. He made some really efficient, macho, muscular action movies back in the day, and now he's stepped away from directing in the early 90s, and now he just works on like sport race cars basically.
Yeah, we talked about him on our underrated underrated directors.
Yeah, yeah. I consider him an underrated director.
That was a good episode. Check that episode out if you haven't heard of people.
So the thing about Shakedown is it's a movie that came out, it came out right around the peak of the buddy cop movies. So this came out the year after Lethal Weapon. Universal Pictures put it out, and for some reason this movie got swept under the rug and buried. Like, nobody really knows about Shakedown that much.
Yeah.
Which is a friggin' shame, because the plot of this movie is that Peter Weller plays a criminal defense lawyer who, by the way, is mighty good at playing the saxophone.
Oh.
Which Josh loves.
Really?
Yeah, he does have some sax. There's some sax in this dude.
Oh, dude.
But he has to team up with this gruff old veteran cop played by Sam Elliott to basically go after corrupt policemen.
Yeah.
And, you know, the thing is, the story's been done to death before, but these guys don't get along with each other. For Sam Elliott, you know, I love Sam Elliott, but he kind of plays the same guy every time, that whole I hate everything kind of attitude. And he has that in this, but, you know, there's all these awesome action scenes and set pieces in this movie. You know, there's a moment where they chase a guy through an amusement park and Sam Elliott ends up on a roller coaster that's in motion, being in fist fight with this guy.
Nice. You know,
there's a scene where they're chasing down an airplane on a runway in their fucking convertible car. There's so many cool action scenes in this, which James Glickenhaus is good at staging. Yeah. And, you know, and I love both leads in this movie. You know, I like Peter Weller in almost everything I've seen him in. I like Sam Elliott. And, you know, they play off each other really well. And, you know, it's got kind of that Say No to Drugs late 80s movie and the corrupt cops. And I'm just like, every time I watch a movie, I'm like, you know, I dig this movie. I really do dig this movie. I wish more people knew about this movie. Hopefully the Shout Select Blu-ray will change that and people will buy it, because I already pre-ordered mine and I never pre-order anything. So that's how much I love Stakeout.
Mm. I remember liking it quite a bit.
Yeah.
I've always liked Sam Elliott too. And I don't find he's always that gruff. I mean, I
in well, not always, house, but you know, his most memorable stuff, he's kind of the gruff guy.
Yeah, and he's cool too.
Yeah. Oh, super cool. And all the ladies love him.
Yeah.
I mean, the guy's cool.
Well, he married Catherine Ross, for God's sake.
Yeah. I want to see that movie he's in, that Hero.
Yeah, I really want to see that too.
Where it's about him, like, being a, like, kind of a washed up actor who's, like, adrift and doesn't know what to do with his life.
Yeah.
I think that would be I think he's really suited for that kind of a movie, I think.
Yeah, I really wish it gave him more of a comeback. I think it was kind of intended to.
Yeah.
Hopefully he'll get an Oscar nom or something. I don't know.
Yeah, we'll see.
Yeah. Okay. Well, this is the only one on my list that you may have on your list.
Okay.
So this one's a movie from 2005.
Okay, it's not.
Directed by Shane Black.
It's not.
Oh, wow. See, I learned my lesson from Freeway on our underrated 90s, because I thought for sure you guys would have that too. Anyway, this is a movie called Kiss Kiss Bang Bang. And I've known about this movie for years. I didn't watch it till recently, because someone told me to. And I love this movie. I thought it was a lot of fun. So it's starring Robert Downey Jr., who I usually don't really like. And he's playing a petty criminal named Harry, and he ends up teaming up with a cop played by Val Kilmer named Gay Perry, and they're out trying to solve a murder, basically. The female lead's played by Michelle Monaghan, who's great. It's also got Corbin Burnson, Rockman Dunbar from Prison Break and Sons of Anarchy, and a small role by Shannon Sossaman. Now, this is a quintessential L.A. movie, and I really love movies set in L.A., as people know. And I just thought this was a really, really well-written, clever, fun flick. And I reviewed it on here recently, because I think I watched it, like, last year.
Yeah.
But, yeah, it's just, I mean, it's just really works, and it's a lot of fun, and I really like the interplay, and that's, you know, kind of a lot of what these types of movies are about.
That's basically what most of mine are, is about the interplay between the two leads.
Yeah, and Robert Downey's kind of, like, you know, flailing around and, you know, kind of obnoxious as usual, and Val Kilmer is quite the serious cop who kind of, like, takes no shit, and it's very kind of cliched in that way. But I just felt that this was, it felt really original to me, even though it wasn't. And
Yeah, I mean, I think Shane Black is a brilliant writer. He kind of originated the genre with Lethal Weapon. And and this is kind of this was kind of almost like a comeback movie for him, I believe. And I thought he totally delivered. And I don't think a lot of people really remember this movie. I think it really flew under the radar when it came out, but it's fucking great. So, and cool. You've seen this as well, right?
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah,
it's a really fun movie.
Yeah.
Okay, so my number two is another movie you probably know is on my list. It's a movie from 1986 starring Gregory Hines, Billy yeah. Crystal, called Running Scared.
And Darlan Flugel. Yeah.
What I love about Running Scared, it's directed by Peter Hyams, who did Busting and Outland, among other things. What I love about this is that, you know, we talk a lot about New York, LA, cops, so on and so forth. This is a movie set in Chicago with right. cops. So right off the bat, interesting locale, because, you know, I'm used to seeing, you know, the movies that are set in Los Angeles with Lethal Weapon set in Los Angeles. And then you're like you were saying, New York.
Yeah.
There's, you know, French Connection and all those kind of movies yeah. are set in New York. So this one's set in Chicago. So automatically interesting, you know, locale, because you don't see a lot of these movies set there. The difference between this and the other movies on my list is that Gregory Hines and Billy Crystal are partners.
Yeah.
And at the beginning of the movie, they are friends. Like, okay. they don't yeah. automatically have to learn to live with each other. Yeah. They're automatically tight with each other. They're automatically great friends. But the reason this is so high on my list is because they are great together.
Yeah.
Like, you wouldn't think Billy Crystal could pull off an action comedy just because, you know, you're used to him in stuff like When Harry Met Sally or, you know, City Slickers and stuff. And Gregory Hines, I've always liked Gregory Hines, and I've always thought that Gregory Hines hasn't got the kind of, you know, recognition he deserves at times.
Yeah.
Because he's great in most things. I really liked him in Wolfen. I really liked him in, like, White Knights and stuff like that. He's really good. White Knights is a cool movie, dude. I don't care what you say. But
I didn't say anything.
You're laughing, though. I was like, whatever.
It just seemed like an odd choice to bring up.
Varishnakra. But, you know, it's them having to go after, like, a criminal underlord and corrupt cops again. It's got rapid fire jokes. It's got them interplaying with, like, they'll go into, like, there's this great scene where they go into one of the bad neighborhoods and they play a game of basketball against the kids there and everything, just to, like, bond with them, but also try and get information. It's got a awesome, awesome action sequence where they're driving their car down a subway line with the trains coming at them. It's a fucking great scene. It's like top notch, one of my favorite action scenes of all time. And it's just the main reason why I like Billy Crystal as much as I do is because I like him in movies like When Harry Met Sally, but I love him in Running Scared.
Yeah.
Like, Running Scared is just one of those movies. Kino Lorber Studio Classics put it out on Blu-ray. And when I heard they were putting it out on Blu-ray, what did I say to you right away? Holy shit, I'm buying that right now.
Yeah.
And I did, because I love Running Scared.
Nice.
And I don't think enough people talk about Running Scared. And if you want to see kind of a samey but different take on buddy cop movies that has people who you wouldn't expect to pull off the action scenes in it, watch Running Scared. And we all have, and both you and I agree, Peter Hyams is a very solid
yeah.
director who, he's usually his own DP, and his movies are always visually interesting, and this is no exception.
Cool. I always like the cover for this one, too, even though it's really simple.
Yeah,
I always
just them
really
standing
cool.
in front of, like, a car, basically,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, I always thought it was a really cool cover.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So my last choice, not ranked.
Ha-ha.
You're going to be like, fuck off, Josh. Is a 1973 film.
Okay.
Starring Pam Grier and Margaret Markov, called Black Mama, White Mama.
Okay.
And
it's a fun movie.
The movie was, the topic was buddy action. And I was trying to think of, okay, what's outside the norm as far as just, you know, two male cops. And I'm like, oh, Margaret and Pam.
No, I actually like this choice.
Yeah. And they,
I actually think it's an interesting choice.
Yeah. So this is kind of a riff on the Defiant Ones.
Oh, totally.
and it takes place in the Philippines, directed by Eddie Romero. So it's part of the whole, you know, Filipino B-movie craze of the 70s.
I'm pretty sure I have the Arrow Blu-ray of this.
Yeah, Arrow put this out on Blu-ray, you're right.
I do.
And, yeah, basically, Margaret Markov and Pam Grier escape from a women's prison and are on the lam through most of the movie. They're handcuffed together for part of it. And, yeah, this is, but I felt like it really fit the tropes. We've got two characters who don't like each other at all.
Oh, they definitely don't.
Yeah, it's racially driven, and it's also, they just think each other are assholes. And, but yeah, as they're chained together and eventually they have to learn how to get along, they have to work together to get out of their situation. And then they, yeah, kind of end up becoming friends and bonding. So it hit all the right beats as far as what this genre is. But yeah, I mean, I just saw what an interesting choice because it's two women and you never talk about women when you're talking about buddy cop or buddy action. Well,
there
action.
Isn't many of them. That's why.
Yeah. So, but yeah, I mean, it's a great fucking movie. I mean, I really, really like it. And this was actually one of the first ones I wrote down for this topic. So, yeah, I mean, if you haven't seen it yet, check it out. Or, you know, you might like the Defiant ones. I mean, I think Midnight Run's kind of a little bit, aren't they
sort of
chained together for part of it as well?
I think they are for a little bit, but yeah. It is kind of the similar kind of style.
Yeah. Yeah. But I mean, yeah, this is a fun flick, especially if you like, you know, B movies from the 70s.
Especially if you like American International B movies from the 70s.
Yeah. Yeah. And Markov wasn't in a ton of movies, but I thought she was great in this. And, Grier, I mean, she was in her prime and kicked ass. And it's got some really good sequences, really good finale. Yeah, I totally dug it. So,
some really good mud wrestling.
What's that?
Really good mud wrestling.
No mud wrestling. <Just kidding. laughs> That's Big Birdcage.
That was my dream.
Or Big Dollhouse.
Yeah, I know. That's my dream for this movie was mud wrestling.
Yeah.
I was like, come on, you're chained together. Why can't you fall in the mud puddle?
Yeah, totally. Yeah, so that's Black Mama, White Mama.
All right, well, my number one is heading back to Shane Black territory.
Okay.
I didn't pick Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, but I did pick my favorite movie of 2016.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that would be The Nice Guys.
Yeah, I figured you would, so.
Yeah. I got to tell you, man. For
it was
a guy,
my favorite movie that year, too.
Yeah. Yeah. That's one of the, what, that's, that we both had the same number one.
Yeah.
Was a feat.
Unheard of.
Yeah. But I just got to tell you, like, for a guy like me who loves these kind of movies to begin with.
Yeah.
To have, like, Shane Black, the guy who basically originated them, come back, like, like 30 years after Lethal Weapon, yeah. And be like, hey, check this shit out. I'm going to reinvent the buddy cop movie. And I'm like, you damn well right you are.
Yeah.
I love The Nice Guys.
Yeah.
I love it. It is like so much fun. It was the most fun I've had in the theaters in at least the last 3 to 4 years.
Yeah. It's really, like, really good.
It's, you got, you know, Russell Crowe teaming up with Ryan Gosling. Russell Crowe's kind of like a, you know, he's kind of a down on his luck detective. Ryan Gosling's kind of an alcoholic detective.
Yep.
And you know, they have to team up to solve murders. Like the basic first scene is a car crashing through a party that has a dead porn star in it.
Yeah.
And they have to figure out what's going on. You know, Along for the Ride, this is a triple buddy movie though, because Along for the Ride is Ryan Gosling's teenage daughter, played by N'Gori Rice. And she's fucking great in this movie, too, because she's always the one who has to drive Ryan Gosling's drunk ass everywhere because he's too hammered and too much of an alcoholic to drive his car. So he gets his 13-year-old daughter to drive him around.
Yeah.
You know, this has some fucking humor, the best humor I've seen in a comedy. Like this movie, I totally laughed my way through the whole thing. I never thought Russell Crowe could pull a movie like this off. Him and Gosling are perfect together.
Yeah.
There's great scenes in this. There's a fight. There's a friggin' sword fight with Keith David, for fuck's sake.
Yep.
What more do you need in a movie? Keith David, I'm fucking there. I'm automatically on board. You know, you've got a great scene where they go up to Russell Crowe's apartment and, you know, these thugs bust in and they're shooting at them. And they're diving out of the way and they shoot the girl across the alleyway.
Yeah.
It's fucking hilarious. It's great.
Yeah.
You know, it's just like, you know, Last Boy Scout, Shane Black wrote, you know, it's a fun movie. Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, he wrote and directed. Also a great movie.
Yeah.
Lethal Weapon, the guy doesn't do wrong in this genre. And you know, I love The Nice Guys. I've watched my Blu-ray even twice. I've seen this movie a bunch of times.
Oh, really, eh?
Yeah, okay. I like this movie a lot. And I'm very disappointed that it didn't get the recognition it deserved. Like, I don't know if it's because this subject was passé when it came out, but I was like, when I went to see it in the theaters, I was like, oh, there's a lot of people here. Maybe this movie will do well. And then it didn't. And then it got ignored for everything. And I'm just like, I don't get it. But I love Shane Black.
I thought there would have been a sequel for sure.
Yeah, I know. Like, I would love a sequel to this movie.
Because it was kind of set up in a way.
Yeah. And I love Shane Black. I think he does a lot of really cool stuff. I'm really looking forward to The Predator. But when I was thinking of buddy cops, I'm like, Shane Black's got to be on my list. What Shane Black movie do I like the most?
Yeah.
And The Nice Guys is the Shane Black movie I like the most.
Yeah.
So.
Cool.
That's my top choice.
All right. There we go.
So let's talk about the ones that didn't make it.
Okay.
Do you have any?
I think I have a lot like in my head, but I didn't really write them down.
I'll just quickly go through a couple things and then we'll recap then. So there's two movies that I had thought about putting on my list that I really remember liking, but I have not seen them in over 20 years. So I was like, I'm not doing it because I don't feel comfortable doing it. The first one of that is a 1990 movie called Downtown, starring Forrest Whitaker and Anthony Edwards.
Right.
Where Forrest Whitaker's the cop in, like, the hood. Anthony Edwards is the white bread cop who has to come into the hood and team up with him. Culture clash ensues.
Yeah.
Directed by Richard Benjamin, who's more of a... He's an actor, but he's more known for comedies.
Yeah.
I remember having a lot of fun with it, but I don't remember enough about it to put it on a list. The other one is not on my list simply because I don't think if I rewatched it, I would think it's the greatest, but I think I'd have a lot of fun with it because I did when I originally saw it. It's a Canon Films movie from 1987 starring Billy Dee Williams and Robert Carradine called Number One with a Bullet.
Wow.
And it's actually a lot of fun too, but it's one of those ones that it was unavailable for such a long time. It's been out on MGM On Demand for a couple years now,
right.
And I've just been hesitating buying that because I'm always wary of the on-demand service.
Yeah.
Because I'm always like, well, it's just a burnt copy. I feel kind of weird paying $25 for a burnt copy. I mean, it's official packaging and everything, but it just feels weird buying that kind of stuff sometimes.
Yeah.
So those are the two that didn't make my list, but I was considering. But again, I didn't have enough. It wasn't recent enough for me to think, oh, those could probably make it on. You know, those were fun.
What's interesting about those choices is that I was actually thinking after I thought of Black Mama, White Mama, I was like, were there any like blaxploitation cop movies? Because that would be really interesting, like the whole culture clash thing, and I couldn't come up with any. So it's funny that you brought up two movies with a black cop and a white cop.
Yeah, that is pretty funny,
and
isn't it?
Because I was racking my brain, because I was thinking of blaxploitation.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Like, I'm like, were there any? Like, did Shaft ever team up with a white guy? Like, and I couldn't think of any. So that's funny.
Okay, and then the two that I put that I was like, I'm just going to throw these out there for shits and giggles because I've talked about them so much. I didn't want to put them on a buddy cop list, and I wasn't sure if they would be considered buddy cop movies to begin with. And that would be The Hidden from 1987.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, that's kind of borderline.
Yeah.
But I've talked about that movie enough. I've talked about it on the underrated 80s. I've talked about it on space alien movies. I've talked about The Hidden a shit ton.
Yeah.
So I don't need to talk about it more. And then the other one from the same year from 1987, I had RoboCop written down as a possible buddy cop movie. Buddy movie. Because he does bond with his partner. And his partner does look out for him. And I was like, it was very loose, but it could maybe fly.
It's very, well, just because they're not together enough.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
Would be where I'd be like,
well, that's what I mean. Like, he kind of goes off on his own for the whole midsection of the movie.
Yeah.
So I was like, well, it could apply, but I'm not going to put it on because I just don't feel like it's 100% fits with what we're talking about.
Yeah.
So those were what I had written down as extra stuff.
Okay, and I mean, a couple others that I would kind of come to mind would be Stakeout, which I mentioned earlier.
Yeah, I actually quite enjoyed Stakeout, yeah. But again, I haven't seen it in a long time,
so don't know if it holds up. But
that's Richard Dreyfuss,
Emilio Estevez
movie, yeah, where they are on a stakeout. Yeah. Go figure.
Yeah, and as much of a, you know, kind of as gross as Brett Ratner is, I did think the original Rush Hour was pretty fun.
Yeah, I couldn't get into that one. I think it's
watch it?
Yeah, it's because I don't like Chris Tucker.
Yeah, I don't really like Chris Tucker either, but I did like it. I thought it was a pretty fun movie.
And another one, Tango and Cash.
Yeah, there was a lot of, yeah,
with Tango Stallone and Cash. And Kurt Russell.
I also thought a Harley Davidson and the Marlboro Man could be one. And yeah, I mean, there's tons.
But these are movies that are fun, but aren't particularly our favorites.
Yeah, that's exactly. And that's the problem. And there are also ones like, there was a shit ton of these movies, yeah, in the 80s, but I haven't seen so many of them in so long that I just don't know. Like, you know, what, and this happens all the time with, and it's happened in reverse, like even tonight on, like, you know, Quarter or King Solomon's Mines. I hated it in the 80s, but yeah, now I like it. But there's a lot that go the other way where I love them and now I'm like, what the hell? Yeah. So I just don't feel comfortable putting movies on a list like this if it's been that long.
Well, that's what I mean. All of the five that I have on my list, yeah, I've seen within the last 5 years.
Yeah.
So that's why I'm confident with what I picked.
Yeah.
I mean, and some of them I've seen multiple times in the last 5 years. Like Nice Guys, I've seen 3 times.
Yeah.
You know, I've seen Shakedown enough times in my lifetime and within the last 5 years, no, Shakedown was a guaranteed from the get-go. So
yeah, I need to watch Shakedown again.
Yeah, you've got the disc. You yeah, have no excuse. So let's recap our list and then we can call it a night.
Okay.
I'll go first. I had Midnight Run from 1988, Hot Fuzz from 2007, Shakedown from 1988, Running Scared from 1986, and The Nice Guys from 2016.
Okay, and I had Kiss Kiss Bang Bang from 2005, The Killer / Hard Boiled from 1989, 1992, respectively, 7 from 1995, Lethal Weapon 2 from 1989, and Black Mamba White Mamba from 1973.
Awesome. I think those were pretty solid lists.
I think they were. I mean, considering I was a little, like, leery of the topic, I thought I did okay. And
no, I like how you stepped outside of the box on yours because, you know, they are good choices. Like I said, 7 definitely was a consideration for me, and the Black Mamba White Mamba,
yeah,
totally makes sense.
Cool.
Totally makes sense. So if you want to weigh in with your buddy action cop kind of movies that you like, you can find us on all social media platforms. That would be Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, just by searching GBW Podcast. And I'm going to do this spiel again because Josh loves it. Because
it works so much.
If you could be so kind to go to iTunes, give us a star rating. It only takes a couple seconds. And even a review, it'd be much appreciated because you might hear this spiel on other podcasts, but it's true. When those ratings and reviews start coming in, it does bump you up on the thing that shows you most popular podcasts and things like that, which does bring in more listeners. And if you don't want to do that, hell, just tell a friend about us. Bring someone on board and let them listen to our podcast and let them see what you guys enjoy. Okay? So that's it.
All right.
Until next time.